thank you for your little thing that you gave. Like it was a kind of response, a little bit, you
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
you were. You were
Yeah, I have my reputation, and I am, you know, I'm from the perspective of the average, whatever that means, devotee. I'm an extreme far right fascist, misogynist, and everything else you could think of.
Well, we can maybe get to those some of those points earlier,
Yeah.
but to get back to what you just said, and you gave that little video about, you
Yeah,
know, read Chaitanya Charitamrita, and you were really kind of saying, we don't need all this thing honored. But to tell you the
we don't need
truth,
what? You don't need what?
you were saying, oh, you don't have to say you are honored to have me
Oh,
here. You were kind of
yeah.
you were being kind of all humble and everything,
Well, not
but
really humble. Look, we've
I know,
yeah.
but I'm a musician, okay, and I
Yeah.
perform on stages. And
Yeah.
the MC and many people, they will just say, "We are honored today to have,"
Okay.
you know. It's you know, even I watch crazy things like America's Got Talent or American Idol, and some of these students are suddenly they have to do a duet with one of their great pop idols, you know, and they're chatting, and they all go, you know. And the guys, they're both going, I'm honored to sing with you. I'm honored. It's not a big thing. I'm honored,
Okay.
you know,
Okay.
it's a,
Okay. All right.
you know, it's it, no, it's just, or you
It's
see, it could be,
standard etiquette.
I suppose one can kind of misconstrue it that your honor, you know, like in a judge in a court, you know, yes, I must bring the case before your honor, you know, everybody in wigs and pompous stuff, you know, but it's just a kind of, it's respectful. It's like saying gee. And actually, to tell you the truth, I really do. The reason I say honored is because in my whole life, really, the only other sannyasi or person who ever came out to kind of like meet me in my home was Mahavishnu.
Mahavishnu, I knew you were going to say that. Mahavishnu.
But then we had a
He's
very
a man of
strange con.
the people.
Yes, and also we knew each other from Nepal and India, and he knew our whole gang, Pitambar and Achaitrust, naughty
The
boys.
Chapati Express.
Yes.
Remember
We were
the
all
Chapati Express?
very, very well. I can tell you some stories about the Chapati Express that shouldn't be on public knowledge, and you don't want to be associated with the name even. But it was great, great. Well, the thing is this, the only, I have to say, at the beginning of COVID, I suddenly
Yeah.
get a phone call. Who from? Vishaka. You know, who's the new temple president of Bhaktivedanta Manor? And I was just like, wow, nobody from the temple has ever called me up to say, how are you, Mathura? Just checking to see how you are. I was like, wow, you know. So things like, you know, I have a reputation as well. And, you know, people like me, they find I'm endearing, but, you know, I'm not a saint. I'm not known for following the straight and narrow. I'm also not a kind of ISKCON basher or anything like that, but I'm a critique. But I'm out of the picture, you know, really, you know. I mean, when I left ISKCON in 1980 officially, I kind of was one of the early fringes. What they used to call, you know, and it was that's something. Okay, before I go off on that tangent, did you want to do some chanting, or did you want to?
Well,
Is this going to be edited?
it didn't really work out last time. The synchronization didn't really work out, so I thought we'd leave it this time because I was we had there was some kind of time gap or something.
There was. I mean, you're quite synchronized now. I can see your lips and the sound coming quite well together, but. It was because when I did those videos that you saw of me, that was a weird experience for me standing, sitting in front of a screen, me seeing myself, and I don't have any, you know, backup instrumentalists or musicians. And it's a kind of, especially while doing the chanting, having to do the call and the response was quite exhausting. But it was a good sadhana, you know, it's good sadhana. And, I was just wondering, when I took a few questions, I saw the six videos or so that Rishikesh sent to me. I asked before, can you send me some videos? And then I think I've seen another one, a couple of ones, the ones on Harikesh. And there was another one you had on, was it polemics?
Why I speak on polemic topics, something like that.
Yes. That was, you know, I'm trying to. Okay, because you have a reputation, and you gave a list then of all the things that people apparently accuse you of. The only thing that I have.
Well, I think a lot of the things they accuse me are of true. I mean, I do have a position, and a lot of, you know, some people don't like it.
Right. Yeah.
But calling this term misogynist has come to be, it actually means someone who hates women, which is an extremely, it's a psychotic condition or a demoniac position. But anyone who believes in what we might call traditional values is nowadays a misogynist. It's a misuse of a term, actually.
Okay, I think what we, it's a good, I've been thinking about where I want, would the things I wanted to discuss with you, to try and get to, and to help me understand you, and maybe you understand people like me, and because there's, you know, I think a lot of people might think you are kind of like out of touch with the world.
I think that's quite true.
The majority. So in our conversation,
Go on.
But yeah. I think what we need to do is, because I think what we need to do is when we're talking, just allow the other person to finish the sentence.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Because because we both have a tendency to do it,
right,
and we're both eager, and it helps us hear the other person, because it's and you know, anyway. You get the point, you know.
Yeah.
There's many things I'm quite excited, actually, and it's hard to sometimes retain all the things I want to talk about. But first of all, before we started, you know, because a lot of what we talked about and what you mentioned just yesterday is this love that we have, that we both share of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Bengali culture. We shared that in our last talk. We don't really need to go over that again too much. But I wanted to kind of like go on and add some other things to the conversation. I wanted to respond to the Chaitanya Charitamrita thing a bit. We could talk about that first and then move on to other subjects, because what's interesting is that when I did read the Chaitanya Charitamrita, when it first came out, okay, I literally just started with book one and went all the way through. And I have to say, the last Antalila, some of the they were the most esoteric, and for me at that stage in my bhakti, and even now, a lot of it was too esoteric for me. Okay, but most of when it was the actual Leela of Mahaprabhu and the devotees and everything, I was right there, but I never really developed a habit of continuously reading. It was like, once I've read the book, okay, I've done it. Even with the Bhagavad Gita, I read the Gita before I joined the temple, and I never read it again as a book. Isn't it amazing? I went through classes, and the Bhagavatam, I never really read it as a book. I found it really, I would never in the temple pick up the Bhagavatam and sit down and read a chapter. I found it quite archaic, you know, whereas it was very immediate. I felt Krishna much more through Mahaprabhu and the story than directly in the Leelas, really. That was what kept me going for years. And one of the things with ISKCON is, there was a syndrome, I don't know which year you joined, but it was, we were in the mid
75.
Okay, I joined just, you know, a couple of years before you. So when you joined, we were right in the midst of the expansion of the book distribution story, you know. And there was so much emphasis on getting it out there that it came to Prabhupada's notice that maybe we weren't getting enough in us. You know, we were giving out the books, but did we read them? Did we know what was going on? And then it's funny, you talk to devotees and suddenly you say, that's when I learned all these Bhagavad Gita shlokas. I mean, we all started to go, okay, let's start reading. We started to learn shlokas. But I never really read the books. The Chaitanya Charitamrita was amazing. I got all the philosophy and the story and all of those amazing purports that Prabhupada had from Bhaktisiddhanta, the little details about, you know, when you get off of the train at so-and-so and go down there, you meet the fourth generation of, and you really, then you go, okay, this is where this is all coming from, this place, you know, that's the location. But one thing I was just discussing, because I told you I have an association here with Madan, and Madan is very good at Sanskrit and Bengali, and he's read Chaitanya Charitamrita and Beng. He's one of the wisest devotees I know, and we have a circle, and we started to read Chaitanya Bhagavat, which is really interesting. What was fascinating, I wanted to bring up, and I wanted to, this is a something I wanted to bring up with you, because you're very deeply absorbed in this. This is very much a part of what your spiritual depth is about, is Mahaprabhu and these things. Now, there's a part of me that since leaving the temple has become kind of interested in sociology, history, looking retrospective, trying to understand dynamics, historical, you know, give some other ideas that I didn't have that awareness of, you see. And one of the things is I also have academic friends. I have a friend called Matthew who's done a PhD study on Nagababas, you know, and I know what it means to be an academic. They have to study every work that's ever been written by anybody on that subject before they present their PhD. It's woo. And, you know, and if I ask him a question about something, you know, that, you know, because I'm coming from the traditional point of view, he'll go, ah, but, you know, and so, and it's interesting to know how they look at traditions and cultures, you know, history. Okay, it's because we're looking at, when we're looking at the history, the roots of our tradition are these books, you know, like all religions, they have a book. So we've got the you know, the Bhagavat and the Bhagavad Gita, the Itihas, and so on. And then for Gaudias, we've got these texts. And for most devotees who's, you know, there, we have the Chaitanya Charitamrita that Prabhupada wrote, you know, with all the extensive purports. But then, of course, since then, many devotees, I've read the Sarva Bhavana. What we're using is that Madan and Jagannath Mishra have the original Bengali books with them, and they speak it in Bengali, and I have it, and I read the English, and we go round in a circle, and we've been going through. It's fascinating, because, and then you also realize why Prabhupada didn't translate that, but rather translated Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Didn't translate Chaitanya Bhagavat, you mean?
No, Prabhupada didn't translate it. The Chaitanya Bhagavat.
Bhagavat, yeah.
Yes, he didn't. And I want, and then, so one of my points is about that's a kind of, it can become a test in a sense about how we take literature, okay, that was written after the fact, a hagiography rather than these, that's the technical name for people who may not have heard it, is a hagiography is not a literal historical account. It's a religious devotional text written by devotees in that tradition, generally after the occasion. You know, like in the Bible, so they say, the, you know, the apostles wrote their things and stuff was written later or whatever. Now, I tell you one leela when we were reading the Chaitanya Bhagavat that blew my mind, because I'm so used to the Chaitanya Charitamrita depiction of that leela, which is when Mahaprabhu comes to Puri after taking sannyas.
What happens then?
Yeah, it's quite phenomenally different, actually. It's on a different scale, lots more people involved, and it's a different mood. And then also the meeting of Ramananda Roy and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that's quite differently discussed. Well, I suppose my only point that I want to make at the moment was because you were mentioning read Chaitanya Charitamrita, and I've just been reading Chaitanya Bhagavat, is the how that's affected me now, being 65 years old, and the difference it was when I read Chaitanya Charitamrita as a very simple brahmachari in Amsterdam who just got in contact with the tradition. And now years later, after going to Bengal, traveling in Bengal, hearing things, knowing things, looking at the tradition, and then going, what does that mean for us? And Madan made a very nice point yesterday when I was talking about this. He was going that even if you don't accept that every conversation is that's how it happened, you know, because basically it's how somebody told a story, who told it to somebody else, and somebody else is recollecting it, you know, and that's generally what's happening in a hagiography. I suppose it's about it's this conversation about literalism. And taking the spirit of, you know, and taking into account kind of the bhav and the of the devotees who are writing it, and the fact that they're channeling something, you know, for us. And this is my point, I think, as a subject I wanted to talk about. It's leading to me to time, place, and circumstance. This is a thing I'm a bit obsessed with. You know, that if we don't take into account the period or the, you know, the place, the locality, and the individuals involved, that's how you get into the nuances and the specifics of anything on any level, you know. And that's why there's lots of arguments sometimes on the internet between devotees who take a quote from Prabhupada, And it's taken totally out of context, and they zero on it without seeing any of the thing, and make a kind of a truism out of it, or a dogma, I suppose, you know. So I've gone on a little bit there, and I've, you know, so some of these, it's interesting because those are from reading the Chaitanya Bhagavat. That was one of the things that has struck me now when about And I suppose I wanted to know, to you, when you're reading texts and things like that, you know, like something like that. When I take it, okay, one of the stories, just an example, is Mahaprabhu in Varanasi with Prakashananda Saraswati. And that had a big influence on me, because before even the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita came out, they had said Lord Chaitanya in Five Features, that lovely little book. That really blew my mind, you know, and that front cover where Mahaprabhu's sitting at the place, you know, where they wash their feet, and then Prakashananda's coming over and there's light radiating. And I just remember big effect on me, you see. And then the description of how they all became followers of Mahaprabhu and so on and so forth. But you don't really hear in Varanasi or any historical books about that being a fact, you see. Well, I suppose
I beg to differ there.
Okay, then, please. And I'd like your, that's what I wanted to ask your opinion about.
In as much as there is there's an annual parade in Varanasi commemorating Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's visit there.
Okay. By who, though?
I'm not sure. I haven't ever been in it. I only ever went to Varanasi once. But Prabhupada was invited to join that once, and he went there in the early 1970s. There's also Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in South India. Everyone took to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's cult. Yeah.
Okay, so you've got my point, okay? This is just the point
It may be difficult to historically ratify that, yeah.
Yes. I think, isn't the word, hyperbole?
Hyperbole.
Hyperbole, you know. So I suppose it is when, but at the same time, what Madam, you know, it's like the part of the joy of reading the books is the storytelling. It's the storytelling, you know.
Oh, if you can understand the Bengali, it makes a lot of difference. It gets right to it's heart to heart stuff.
Right. Also, the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Okay, another question I brought up with was just because I just literally discussed things with Madan after seeing your video, and it triggered some things. What was I going to say? Oh God, I've lost my point now. Dearie me. Oh yes, in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, there's hardly even a mention of the name of Radha. You see,
I'm willing to talk about that if you like.
Yes. And then there's the next. So this is connected to what I was talking about before. So when Krishnas Kaviraj wrote the Chaitanya Charitamrita. This was after the Goswamis had written all of their literature. None of that literature existed before when Vrindavan Das Thakur wrote Chaitanya Bhagavat, or the theology hadn't been as systematically developed at that time. So then the Goswamis came, and then in that line, there's Raghunath Das Goswami and Krishnadas Kaviraj, who's getting his, you know, and the books of the Goswamis. So even this is what Madan was saying, that in Chaitanya Charitamrita, what they've done is, Krishnadas Kaviraj, a lot of the time, he's put things into the mouth of Mahaprabhu, were actually written in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu by Rupa Goswami, you see.
But Rupa Goswami was told it by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
I know, but the point is, it's written. What I mean to say is that the theology, because that was a big thing for me. When you read the beginning, that big fat volume at the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's Prabhupada setting the whole. It's all this Nityananda Ram. It's like, who is Nityananda? He's the Vasud. You know, he's
right. The first few chapters of the Adi Leela, they set the philosophical stage.
Exactly. And you know, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Radha Krishna Nahaya, the raison d'etre of why Mahaprabhu is going to come and everything, which isn't there in the Chaitanya Bhagavat at all, in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. So I suppose my point is, it's like, as things go through time, the Chaitanya Charitamrita is quite... let's put it this way: the history of the Gaudiya movement had moved quite a bit from the time of Mahaprabhu's passing. It had gone through the next phase of its development, you know. And Krishnadas Kaviraj, as we know, was very old when he wrote Chaitanya Charitamrita. He was very old. I don't know exactly the date, but it's quite a long distance from the time of Mahaprabhu.
Yeah,
and the purpose of writing Chaitanya Charitamrita was a different reason than Vrindavan Das Thakur's writing. It had a different kind of, in time and place, that, you know, the purpose of that so therefore, to kind of establish what the Goswamis and the Acharyas after that time, they were not just recounting leelas, but establishing the foundation of what that whole philosophy is, like you say, you know. So anyway, I blurred for a long time now. I can allow you to, said you've got something to say about that.
Yeah, I've thought about this quite a lot. I haven't studied it as deeply as I'd like to because I'm busy with other things now. But I do plan to, at some point in time, get into deep scholarly work and writing on Chaitanya Charitamrita, and just impromptu, without systematically studying it, I've written literally hundreds of pages of notes, non-systematically, on Chaitanya Charitamrita about the different pastimes and the implications of it all. It's very exciting to me, actually. There is a book called The Final Word by, I can't remember his name now, Ed Dimmock did the Chaitanya Charitamrita, but he didn't finish it. And his assistant, or the successor, Tony Stewart was his successor acharya or professor in Chicago, whatever it is, religious study of South Asian religions or whatever. So he wrote a book called The Final Word, which I have a copy of, but I haven't read because I don't want to get into that. I do want to get into it, but I don't want to get into it right now because I'm busy with other writing work, which is taking up my time and attention. I need to
contact. He's also done a version. Sorry to butt in. He's done a version of Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Well, it was Edward Dimmock's life work, which he didn't finish it, and Tony Stewart edited it, and so it's written in the name of Ed Dimmock and Tony Stewart. So eventually Tony Stewart wrote a book called The Final Word, and I haven't read it, but from what I understand, it's the Chaitanya Charitamrita is accepted as the final work on Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, considered most authoritative by all Gauriyas in terms of Leela, in terms of Tattva and Siddhanta. It came after the Kettari festival. It came after the Goswamis had written so many things. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami wrote it, taking from Raghunath Das Goswami, told him, and Raghunath Das Goswami got from Swarup Damodar, who was there with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Puri. And Swarup Damodar was also intimately linked with Ramananda Rai. Now, the mood of Chaitanya Bhagavat and the mood of Chaitanya Charitamrita is very different. And like you mentioned, Radha is hardly mentioned in Chaitanya Bhagavat. And there's a reason for that. We find that in the beginning of, as you mentioned, in the Adi Leela, the whole Adi Leela is like the first 8, 9, 10, 11, the first 12 chapters are just like setting the stage. And then then the Leela begins with the birth of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That only goes, the whole of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's childhood and youth pastimes are covered in 4 chapters in Chaitanya Charitamrita. 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 5 chapters. And the reason for that is because they've already been, Krishnadas Kaviraj, have already been extensively discussed in Chaitanya Bhagavat. Now he writes, I believe it's in the 8th chapter of Adi Leela. Is it the 8th chapter? That I'm writing this because the Vaishnavas of Vrindavan, they requested me to write the Antya Leela of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Mm. And we find that we have in Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Leela, which is setting the stage. That's the philosophical understanding of Krishna's the Supreme and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna, the external and internal reasons for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu coming, who is Nityananda Prabhu, who is Advaita Prabhu, the branches of the Chaitanya tree. So it's setting the stage. Oh, and the first chapter, the Guru Tattva. So it's setting the stage. And then we have the Madhya Leela, which is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepts sannyas. He goes to Puri. He travels extensively. There are various pastimes. Chapter 13 is the Rathiatra pastimes, which is, that's really part of the Antya Leela in one sense. Now, and then the Antya Leela, especially we have a lot of esoteric description. And the beginning of the Madhya Leela also, we have esoteric descriptions. It's like a summary of the Antya Leela in case I don't finish it, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says. So we have, it's really getting into the very esoteric descriptions. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he's rubbing his face against the wall. Sometimes his body elongates, so the limbs are not, or the sockets are not joined. Sometimes everything enters into his body like a tortoise in a shell. It's really this is Mahabhav, which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is experiencing. Now, the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita leads up to this, but then when you see content wise in terms of the actual amount, it's not that much of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, but it all leads up to that. Mm-hmm. Now, Chaitanya Bhagavat was written very much in the mood of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu seeing him as Gaur-Narayana.
Yeah.
The Lord of Vaikuntha, who has descended.
Yeah.
But then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he took sannyas. One reason is to go out of Navadvipa and spread Krishna consciousness. That's the term we use nowadays. Although in Chaitanya Charitamrita, we'll find that Krishna Prem is the word is used a lot. But also, he was going out to search for Krishna. And especially when he came to Puri, when he returned after being in South India, and he returned. And at that time, Swarup Damodar came and Ramananda Rai came. Mm-hmm. Now, Swarup Damodar, he's also there in Navadvip Leela, but he's not mentioned. He's Purushottam Bhattacharya. He's hardly mentioned. But he comes in, he's very prominent. He's most prominent in Puri Leela. He's absolutely essential. Yeah. So what's happening is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Navadvip is Gaur-Narayana with his Shaktis, Lakhi Priya and Vishnu Priya. Then he comes out, and when
can I just ask one? This Gaur-Narayan, I mean, and as far as I realized it while reading the Chaitanya Bhagavat, because this isn't really dealt with in the Chaitanya Charitamrita so much, it's this Mahaprakash.
Exactly. It's hardly mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Sapta Praharya Bhav, that's all it says.
I think that's quite important, because it's in those bhavs. And this is quite an astounding thing. When I read the Chaitanya Bhagavat, I had to kind of go, woo, I'm going on a different journey. And I'm entering into a part, an aspect of the Leela that I wasn't familiar with, you see. And what was interesting was that Mahaprabhu would go into these bhavs and he would sit on the altar and he would become Narayan. That's why, you know, and devotees would be falling down, and there's all these incredible, and there was a few of them. And the amazing thing is he goes into those, the way it's described, and then comes out and kind of goes, what happened? Kind of, you know, and it was, it was quite hard for me sometimes jumping between Mahaprabhu identifying himself as Avatar, you know, and the next minute he's the devotee of the Avatar. It was, woo, he's going between the, I never really noticed my emotions or that happening to me reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, but when we went through Chaitanya Bhagavat, went on quite a few times, and I think in Chandrasekhar Mishra's house as well.
Exactly,
Yes,
Chandrasekhar Bhavan. That's where he did his dancing and drama.
Exactly.
And then he took the form of Devi. Ja gore Devi Babe Nachile Nisha. He took the form of Devi and suckled the devotees from his breast. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. I know. And then you got, that's just Mahaprabhu. Then what to speak of, you know, Nityananda. You know, so really these leelas,
One thing, Mathura Prabhu, all due respect to Tony Stewart and Ed Dimmock, we're not going to get it all by our heads. These worshipable, na chaitanya Krishna jagati paramiha. By his mercy, we can begin to touch a drop of the ocean of what is Gauranga. By, of course, devotees are scholars.
Have you seen this picture before?
It's not very clear to me what it is.
It's actually Bengali artist. It's of Nityananda in his Avadhut mode. And according to the description to Chaitanya Bhagavat, it's a fame, you can't see it. Apparently, you see, you know, the way that Nityananda is depicted in most of the ISKCON and art is, you know, he's very...
Oh, not just in ISKCON, in Navadvip, if you go in the shops in Navadvip, you'll find that also. One thing I can never understand is why in the Panchatattva picture, we have Gadadhar with hair, and he's a brahmachari, and Srivas with a shaved head, and he's a grihastha. Although grihasthas can also have shaved heads. Anyway, I was talking about Antilila.
Okay.
There are so many things. I'm going to have to go.
Because it's because you mentioned you were talking about Gaur-Narayan. Instigated the whole thing. Unless you read Chaitanya Bhagavat, you don't see the shift between that and then you read Chaitanya
Bhagavat. There is a shift. What happens in Navadvip Leela, Radha is there as Gadadhara. She is protecting him. She's there to protect him. And that's specifically said. He's searching for Krishna. Mahaprabhu is searching for Krishna. Where is Krishna? In your heart. And Where's Krishna? In your heart. So he starts to rip his heart up. And then Gadadhar tells him, these young boys, youths, that don't worry, Krishna is coming soon. And then he becomes pacified. Then Sachimata tells Gadadhar, you stay with him all the time to protect him. So he's Gadadhar, and Lalita also enters into the personality of Gadadhar. So Radha has joined with Krishna as Mahaprabhu, but she's also coming again. She's worried. What's going to happen to him? Can he handle all of this?
So is this before?
This is in Navadvipa.
This is before he goes to Gaya, or after when he returns?
Actually, I'm not sure. I believe that's even before he has such feelings. But it really comes out after he comes back from Gaya.
Yeah, yeah.
Now
it only is manifest then.
But then, when he comes to Puri, it's actually Rupa Goswami. You'll find the first chapter of Antyalila is Rupa Goswami comes to Puri, and he starts reading his poetry, and he reveals what is on Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mind, which no one could understand. Only Swarup Damodar understood prior to that. And Swarup Damodar didn't tell anyone, but Rupa Goswami told it. And it comes up in the 13th chapter of the Madhyalila in the Rathyatra, where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is singing a Kami song about love. It's not from a spiritual literature. It's a love song, one verse from a love song. And no one could understand why he was singing it. And then Rupa Goswami, in his poetry recitation, he gives the import that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is feeling the mood of Radha at Kurukshetra. This is Rathyatra. Radha at Kurukshetra, where she's got Krishna. For her, every moment is like 12 years or more. She's feeling separation. She's in such feeling. Now I'm going to go to Kurukshetra. I'm going to meet him and then bring him back to Vrindavan. But she's got him. She's seen him. But it's a desperate situation because she's got him, but she can't get him. She wants to bring him to Vrindavan, but she can't because he's already married and he has wives and he's surrounded by army and horses and so many things. It's all that's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, anyway, somehow they bring him. They drag him in a chariot, the Vrajavasis. They bring him to Vrindavan, but he can't stay very long and he has to go. So the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has these feelings, but Rupa Goswami, he initiates everyone. He lets everyone know this is actually what's in Mahaprabhu's heart. And at that time, then Swarup Damodar and Ramananda Rai, then they begin their nightly vigils with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And during the day, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. He had three states of consciousness: external, internal, and in between. Mm-hmm. And especially at night, he'd be completely lost in internal consciousness. He was Radha. During the daytime, he would interact with devotees in a what we might call normal way. And then sometimes he was in between consciousness. Now, Swarup Damodar comes as Lalita to assist. He doesn't manifest that until Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes to Puri. And then Lalita has to protect Radha and help her in her distress of separation. And that's what Swarup Damodar is doing, and Vishakha. Actually, Gorganodesh Deepika puts it round the other way. But
okay,
Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and accepts Swarup Damodar as Lalita, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur accepts also, and Ramananda as Vishakha. But they are anyway similar in many ways. So what's happening is in Navadvip, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna being a devotee of Krishna. Now in Puri, he is Radha. He's Radha Bhav, fully manifested, but that's not for the public.
No.
Now, Rupa Goswami, there are so many things to say here. I've written pages and pages of it.
There is, while I was in the museum in Calcutta, you know, the big one on the, and, you know, I went upstairs, and there's a painting by, he's either Gajendranath Tagore or Abhinendra, I can't remember, one of the Tagore family in that Bengal style. And it's the picture of the fisherman who catches Mahaprabhu in the net. It's an incredible picture, because Mahaprabhu's like really long and he's caught in there. And it's a fantastic picture with the waves and the moonlight. And it's the fisherman going, oh, what have I caught? Because Mahaprabhu was, you know, he fell in the ocean in that state. And he went missing, didn't he, one evening where he escaped.
These kind of things happened all the time. You could never tell what was going to happen. Another important thing is that, the whole Leela, the Vishnupriya is not mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita. There's a whole big chapter in Chaitanya Bhagavat of Vishnupriya's marriage with Nimai. At that time, he's Nimai. He's not Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The name Chaitanya doesn't come until he accepts. We won't find.
Yeah, of course.
Then his sannyas. What a big thing that is to the people of Navadvip. But it's mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita, but in a very different way to the way it is mentioned in Chaitanya Bhagavat, and especially in Chaitanya Mangal. They make a very big thing of his sannyas and how the people of Navadvipa are lamenting for him.
Yeah.
And up to the present day in Navadvip, they stress on Vishnupriya.
Yeah.
Whereas in the just like the Gauri Amat or those who worship Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his sannyas lila, his antya lila, they put emphasis on Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Radha Krishna Nahayan. That's established right at the beginning of Chaitanya Charitamrita. Yeah. Right at the beginning, there's a difference. The very first verse of Chaitanya Bhagavat is in the awe and reverence mood. Ajanu Lambita Bujo Kanakab. And then in Chaitanya Charitamrita, right at the very beginning, we have also Na Chaitanya. There's no higher truth than Chaitanya, actually, even higher than Krishna. Another reason that Chaitanya Charitamrita is considered the final word is because it philosophically establishes the position of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and so many other philosophical points are put there. But then there's also right in the beginning of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Radha Bhava Dyuti Suvalitam Nomi Krishna Sarupam. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Radha and Krishna. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is wanting to understand what is the happiness that Radha experiences in relation to me? What is the sweetness? For this reason, he came as this. Another thing, Antilila, it's not very long, and it doesn't last very long, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he's Krishna. And the bhava of Radha, it's too strong. The woman, she can, the greatest pain, I'm talking in the material world, the greatest pain is borne by women, not by men, bearing children. It's more than kidney stones or anything. So Radha, the pain of the pain of separation from Krishna that she feels, he can't take it for very long. And then what does he do? He disappears into Gopinath, Gadadhar's Gopinath. He enters, then he again becomes Krishna like this. These are my understandings. I don't think it's written anywhere. I've written it in my notes.
Okay.
It's cool. It may be published at some point in time.
No. To get back. One thing that kind of another point, which is to do with some of the conundrums facing our branch of the tradition, the Bhaktisiddhanta, specifically that branch. And now the whole kind of Vaishnava, diaspora, whatever the word is, you know, the spreading. Because I also wanted to make a point about the difference between the Hare Krishna ISKCON move institution and the broader Krishna movement, which is kind of really massive. There's a devotee in England now, can't remember his name, but he's doing a whole research on Hare Krishna in England. And there's like about 20 different sub branches from in England of different Vaishnava lineages. Okay. And then there's lots of people a bit like me who consider themselves non-aligned, you know. I'll talk about a funny thing to do with that non-aligned, which was with a meeting in Mayapur, including Jayapataka Maharaj, where it was sanctioned. Okay. I'll tell that story because it's related to this. Okay. You may have known Paramadvaiti. I won't get into that story, but he had that Vishva Vaishnava Sabha thing he created. And to kind of, Jayapataka started his one, you know, to kind of go, well, you know, I'm going to organize one very similar. So, and I used to go every year to Mayapur to the festivals, you know, and I was kind of very fascinated what's going on, even though I'm living down by the guts and not living in it. So it was announced that in Prabhupada's Samadhi, there was going to be a meeting and Jayapataka was going to host it.
That wasn't Jayapataka Maharaj's idea. That was Prabhupada's idea. The Bhaktivedanta Swami Charity Trust, Prabhupada set it up, and one of the aims was to unite the Gaudiya family.
Okay, well, there you go. So there... But Paramadvaiti had been doing his one under a different kind of auspice, you see. And so this was Jayapataka starting to do this one. So I thought I'd go along. And so we all kind of like sat in a circle, and there was different representatives from the different various Gaudiya Mats and other people and godbrothers like Gokulananda was there. I know.
Which Gokulananda? From England.
England. Yes,
yeah, there's another Gokulananda Prabhupada disciple in Canada.
Okay, now this is English Gokulananda.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He lived in Mayapur for years. And then So we're all sitting around, and before he kind of, nobody knew kind of how to get started. So Jayapataka was busy. He came and sat down and said, okay, have you not got organized yet? Okay, let's go round the circle and we'll write down who's who and which mutt you belong to. Okay. So as they went round, and I was sitting one side of Jayapataka and he was going round the other side, and it was, you know, Puri Maharaj's mutt, and you know, so and so Maharaj or Brahmachari, and went round. And then he came to me and he looked at me and he knows me from years, you know, and he goes, so Mathura, who do you represent? And out of the top of my mouth, where spontaneously I said, well, I represent all the non-represented, you see. I'm going to represent the non-represented because there's many people who can't be here who don't belong to affiliated with any specific mutt at this moment, at this time, you know. And he said, no, you have to be. And then actually the other brothers, everybody agreed with me. They said, no, don't have to be. Why should you have to be? And Gokulananda said, yes, it's true, Maharaj. You know, in England there's, and in places, there's so many devotees who have kind of maybe affiliated with mutts before or organizations, but now they're kind of independent.
Which year was this approximately?
2000 and something, you know, goodness gracious, around the turn of the millennium, you know, around that time. I used to go every year, you know, it was around this time. And so it was like written down in the charter on the day, you know, it's officially accepted that there is a branch or of not, and I started to call it Anna. You know, and it was a kind of a spoof kind of breakaway called the Alliance of the Non-Aligned. That's what it stood for, ANA, you know. And I got a bit obsessed with it, actually. So I thought I'd just bring that in because it's that's kind of who I am, in a sense. I'm just somebody who's been through this whole story, was a kind of gung-ho member of ISKCON, and then that, you know, that series of talks, it explains my whole journey in detail, what happened, why I kind of officially left the organization. Not that I left the Vaishnavism or Prabhupada, but I could not be part of the institution.
Officially leave because you never officially joined. I mean, there's no... What does it mean to be a member of ISKCON? That's still undefined.
Well, okay.
In your own mind, you're non-aligned, but you... I mean, there are many different... I think it's a mental thing. Just like I got an email just a few days ago from a godbrother who said, now I'm not in ISKCON anymore. And there was no difference in... He's living in a city in North America away from any ISKCON temple. So he never goes to any ISKCON temple anyway. It's just... It was a mental flip for him.
Well... I might slightly I find that there's some nuances within this understanding, you know, because I mean, before I joined the ashram and moved into it, I actually had some very, very powerful experiences with Krishna, you know, but I've only had a few in my life on that level, which are like the big ones, you know, and I talk about it. One was in a factory before coming to, you know, I entered, something happened that was so beyond anything, from any high or from any drug, from anything, and I couldn't manufacture that experience, you know. So I thought, well, look.
Mercy. Yeah.
I've got this theory, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, I've been reading it, heard all the theory, this, and you know, and it's like, you have a theory, you do it, have an experiment, you do the experiment, and then you get this result. And I go, wow. So, you know, I joined this thing, okay, this organization, because I knew that somewhere within all of that was this thing that I experienced, But when I got into that thing, that was what my whole story is about. You suddenly discover what this thing is that you've joined, and it's incredible, because as soon as you join it, you know, it's like, okay, I'm seeing Radha and Krishna there, but you know, I've got pictures of Ganesh and Shiva and everything. As soon as you kind of like walk into that, get the kind of this connection to this story, this Prabhupada, basically, and our story, you suddenly get not just connected to all the people of the Hare Krishna ISKCON movement, you get connected to the cosmic family. You know, suddenly you're introduced to the everybody in the Bhagavatam. Who are Shiva? Who is Ganesh? What are the planetary systems? You know, and who you are, and then who's Mahaprabhu? And then you kind of you enter into this, getting connected to this whole. And then it's for me, a devotee like you, I think we also the culture itself of India, which is permeated by the not everybody's trip, but definitely for people like you and me. Just by that one thing of chanting Hare Krishna, you suddenly enter into this kind of whole package.
Right. The lion, the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe. You go through the wardrobe, you're in another world.
When I joined in Amsterdam, it was this kind of factory that had been converted. And Surabhi, you know, who designed Vrindavan and Bombay, it was his first thing he designed. And it was like the TARDIS from Doctor Who. You went in, you opened the door, and it was like bright pink with arches and Krishna. And it was like this thing, you know, you're walking through Amsterdam, cold and gray, and there's this kind of psychedelic, you know, Hindu world in there, you know. And so I walked into that, and then... you're connected with this family, okay? Yeah. And then in Amsterdam, you've got Italians, and suddenly I've gone into this world. I've left home. I'm only 17-year-old, and I've joined this organization just from chanting Hare Krishna because I got this zapped. But now I've decided to not go to college but go into this thing. And then within, as soon as you go there, I get my friends, Vimukta Sangha and Hare Krishna and Paravida. And then especially Vimukta Sangha, I got to understand all the background. And through Kulashekar, then I found out there was politics between, you know, the GBC. What's the GBC? So what happens is that when you joined this organization, this is the reality of it, you became a part of you know, it's like joining a monastery, you know, if you were a monk and you kind of follow chastity, you know, poverty and obedience, it's a similar type of thing. And then didn't matter where you came from. Okay, my book, I've, you know, this talks. I give all this complex story about, you know, Southwest London, parents, the school, the thingy, the LSD, the rock groups, the spiritual thing, ISKCON, you know. And then you join it, and there's all these other people who've come to that little place in Amsterdam. And they haven't had, come from the same stories, may have shared some of the stuff. And that was always been fascinating, because what happens is everybody puts on a uniform. Everyone shaves their heads. We put on the tea light. We all put on saffron. And within 1 week of being in the temple, there was this guy from Sri Lanka. He looked, you know, the whole thing, because he had Indian. And he blooped, learned a new ISKCONism from it, blooped with a whole bunch of money from Sankirtan. And I was like, yeah. And I was shocked, because I was very naive. I couldn't understand how someone... We're all there for, what I meant was we were all there for various reasons. And then you would hear everyone's stories and why they ended up there, what they were. And they all had different reasons, and then their backgrounds. And then you become aware, oh, goodness, there's a place over, there's a temple in Paris, you know, and then in one in Germany. And you get to see the Back to Godheads with all the pictures of your God brothers and sisters over there in France. This is what it was like for me. And then you got all the cassettes from New York, you know, and you get, who's that Badaraj? Oh, all right, Yogeshwara, who are they? You know, oh, that's the guy that paints the picture on there. And then you go, okay, I'm part of this big thing, you know. And and that's because we had Tulsi Das, who was a bit, who, you know, quite an old devotee from America. And then we had Mani Bunda. And then we had Bhakti Jan, who was from like 1965. And then we had Petito Duran, who'd been in Boston in the late 70s. You know, they were all in Amsterdam. So we had all these people coming in, various people. And I was like the youngest. So for me, it was very much joining something. It was a community. I'd done this very deliberately. I had to have very powerful experience. I went through big decisions. Shall I go college? It's like the Matrix. Do I take the red pill or the... And I said, no, I'm not going to go that way. I'm going to go this way. And often in my life, I've had to revisit this time. Because my mother, while I was going through all this, she was very reasonable. And, you know, she said, why do you have to be all or nothing? Why don't you stay and do your art course? Because I've been accepted to do a foundation. And then, you know, carry on your Krishna pursuits, you know, in parallel, you see. Now, if I'd done that, are you there?
Yeah, I'm
there. Oh, God, you're so quiet. I thought maybe the film would stop.
Okay, I'll give a few oohs and ahs now and then.
It was, so it's this. I'm telling all this in response to this thing about you saying joining and not joining. But for me, it was a big thing. And you see, this is part of the whole time, place and circumstance context story, because you could have been somebody over in London in Berry Place or in the Manor, a devotee going through at the same time as me. I think Krupa Moya joined 1 year later than me, and you know, I had my whole experience in Amsterdam with what was going on there, and it was incredible because the people in Amsterdam, you know, they had lots of problems with Hanse Dutta, the GBC, you know. So what I realized that I've joined this movement, but I've taken on all these, this kind of like a hierarchical power structure that was how the organization worked, you see. And I realized that this has had a big effect on all the people that were in my, you know, these were my, I was looking up to them, especially Kulashekar, until they all had real problems with the GBC, you know. And Amsterdam was a bit slightly rebelly like that, because it wasn't like we are under the GB, you know. It was like, so I realized there was this. So for me, when you leave ISKCON, for, you wouldn't believe how many people, devotees, have been damaged spiritually. Because they've actually been connected to, because the whole, you know, the, it's about being connected to God, Krishna. But then what happens is the movement, the organization takes over, and the Krishna becomes just a kind of a background thing. And the organization and the institution becomes the main thing.
Weberism.
Sorry?
Weber, Max Weber. He
exactly. Yes. So I discovered him when I was writing my book, because I was fascinated by that book that came out, The Post-Charismatic Fate of a Religious Transplant. And it was this word charisma. It was this word charisma. And
yeah, post-charismatic is right out of Weber.
Yeah, I know. But it's that's how I discovered him. And then this whole, I think he's very in it. And also Maslow, he was the one that this quote where he said that the people who join groups, what happens is they may have joined for initially from a mystical or a spiritual reason. But then what happens is the group becomes the main focus.
So we have to keep Krishna in the center.
Yeah.
Always
so what happens is
Krishna.
Like, okay, when you're at school, you know, who have you got to look out for? Oh, God, the prefects, you know, in our school, you know, look out for the prefects. They're going to catch you doing this or doing that, and they're going to make you have a... And there's this fear structure, you know. So in ISKCON, you have this kind of structure. It all depends where you were. But there would be this GB, somewhere in it, there would be a GBC, okay? And that would be defining, you know, the what was going on. Now, being a young Sankirtan devotee, none of this really affected me. It only happened a little bit when I became a bit maturer after I'd gone to India, come back, and suddenly I was this, suddenly in the structure of the temple, I'd suddenly gone from just a new chap who was a new guy being trained, going on Sankirtan, to somebody back in the temple. It's when Lochanananda was the temple president from 75 to 77. Makes a big difference, you see.
You're an experienced devotee now.
Yeah, compared. Yeah. So you're suddenly seeing things.
When I joined someone who'd been in the movement 3 or 4 years, they were like a really senior man.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, when I joined that Britannia Strat, we only had the third canto of the Bhagavatam printed. Mm. Nobody knew anything else. You know, Patita Dharan was the expert, Patita Pavan, he calls himself now. Nobody, so he would give all these talks. He'd been studying it for 5 years. That was a long time, you know. Yeah. He'd been, you know, 5 years was really, really advanced, you know. So, and then suddenly I'm in that position where I was leading kirtans. I learned to learn to play mridanga from Kulashekar, who learned from Prabhupada. I became a kind of kirtan man, you know, and everything. I wasn't big on talks, you see. So then Bhagavan, see, Hansa Duda had been the GBC, and then he went. So we were very, very aware of politics, you know, and there was the whole thing when the Schloss Rettishof got attacked by the police and the money went, and we had the Preetu regime that was awful, and he left and went. So there was all this thing, and I went through a crisis I've joined this thing. I'm part of this thing. I've joined this thing, you know. And this is what, you know, part of people's, so you're spiritual journey becomes a mixture of many things. It means what you can pick up from your kirtan, your, you know, the devotee sangha, but then there's the pressure of the actual dynamics of whatever's going on around the characters, you know, in that organization. And that's what a lot of people who are in the hurry, you know, in the Krishna movement, but have left the movement, is because they had enough of all of that, you know. And say if you talk to like Jaya, who is a very nice lady, she was married to Vinod, and then she had a relationship with Mrigapati just before he passed. She's an almost identical age to me, but then she told me what it was like when kind of they went through Hansa Duta, then Jayatirtha, and then Bhagavan, and then Bhagavan. And then on the day that Bhagavan disappeared, you know, she just left because she said, oh, God, you know, all these, you know, we, you know, because if you, that's why I left the institution, because I thought now what it's become is this thing. It's an organization that suddenly shifted its focus, okay, from making disciples. It's all about preaching and getting, you know, getting those books out and making new devotees. But for who? My God brothers. They all just wanted to, it was now, if you hadn't signed up for this new regime, then you're going to be somehow ostracized. Like you mentioned, you were kind of being in, if you were in Bangladesh or in Thailand or somewhere like that, you were kind of out of the zone a little bit. You maybe had Jayapataka kind of buzzing in a little bit, or, you know, I went on the library party when I came to India, and it was fantastic. It was just four guys going in a truck. It was fantastic. No GBCs. The whole idea was get away from GBCs and all of these things, you know, because you're talking about. So what it means is to leave, when you're in the organization, you have to accept the role of the GBC somehow or other in your life. If you're, and then there's also this thing in the old days, ISKCON was just a building and an ashram where you were the in or out, you know. And then you had a few little communities starting up, and not in Europe, they were all in America, you know, because it had been established. And even in Amsterdam, we only had a couple of grihastas. That you, all these complex sociological problems of educating children, gurukulas, we didn't even, when I was there in my prime time in ISKCON, they weren't even social issues. And we only had sannyasis briefly coming through. We didn't have to deal with sannyasi trips either, because that was a big thing, you see, as you know, like Vyasaki deals with it. And, you know, the whole thing with Tamal Krishna and with Guru Kripa and all those guys, the heavy guys, all going around the temples and stealing brahmacharis. And that caused the whole big scene. You know, people were terrified of the sannyasis, you know, and their influence, you know. Anyway, I've yabbered on a little bit. I suppose it is, that was all in response to what you just said about being in or out. And I just wanted to give, I feel that it's easy to say something simple like that, but actually I think about these things in detail. And this is what I'm coming to, another question, I suppose.
Well, I was making the point that it's not well defined what it means to be in or out.
Yeah, but then time, place, and circumstance. What
I mean, it could be, it could be someone like yourself living in some place in England, a long way from any temple, thinks I am a member of ISKCON.
Yeah, not, but necessarily. I don't.
I know, but I'm saying it's not just a matter of geographical location. It's more it's more a case of psychological location.
Yeah,
What you identify with.
What has actually happened is that there are people who are actually connected with the institution. You know, they are kind of like, they got bonds with the management, or even if they don't, they live outside, but they, you know, they identify with that temple, you see. But there's loads and loads of other people who are kind of followers of Narayan Maharaj, or non-aligned people who not just geographically, but they're just not into institution. It doesn't have any relevance whatsoever in their life for most people. And for many people, the only the great thing that ISKCON, the institution, does, these fabulous festivals, they do it so well, Ratiyatras, they're excellent at these, you know. No little small group or anybody else could get it together and put on these things, you know. And big things, you know, like in India, like, I mean, but my Mayapur is outrageous, you know, how they're, the, you know, the level of the cooking and the quantities and the organization and, so, you know, prasadam and festivals. This is in terms of kind of impressive, you know, on, because, you know, ISKCON isn't what it was then, you know. You know, I've calculated, I think, I know in England, the amount of actual disciples that Prabhupada probably initiated was less than 400, I can imagine. There was never that many, you know, actual initiated by Prabhupada, you know. It's amazing how people thought there was Hare Krishnas everywhere, but it's because devotees used to travel in vans and, you know, and then that became less conspicuous because everyone put on disguises and things like that, you know. But so the Krishna movement, okay, which is very, very, very large and involves a huge amounts of different people with different opinions, you know. And I've discovered more about this just by being on Facebook over the last 10 years, you know. By having social media, I've realized, God, there's all these people and there's, you know, there really is these various types of kinds of devotees. It's unbelievable. And the demographics have changed, you know. It was all focused before in America and Europe. Now you go, you know, you see these gatherings in Ukraine that they have in places, and you look at these pictures of thousands and thousands and thousands of devotees, you know, all these young, you know, Russians and Eastern Europeans. And I mean, it's whatever's going on over there in ISKCON, in terms of ISKCON, it's got this kind of story going. It's a kind of quite, you know, so I suppose my question, one of my questions is that when, or I've heard a few people discussing about you, but not in many, many details. And one of the things that, and I'm quite chitter-chatty with a lot of women, you know. And there's a lot of the women who I'm titty-tatty with are quite kind of more modern progressive types, okay? And so they find, or one of the questions is that, how is it, or why should a sannyasi, whose luck, as you know, you're also known for being very simple, you've got a very good reputation for, you know, being a paka sannyasi, I suppose. That's why a lot of people, in, you know, have become very kind of cynical of people in saffron robes and the respect that the whole kind of position of a sannyas has, because we've seen so much farce related. And not only that, it was one of the things that Prabhupada officially regrets in his books, isn't it? He actually goes, I, you know, gave prematurely a sannyas to many foreigners and they weren't quite ready, but for the sake of preaching and so on. So some of the things that you've said, I think you have a book called it Mutterjis and Masters.
Mothers and Masters.
Mothers and Masters. I haven't read it, I have to say. So I'm not sure.
A lot of the people who criticize it haven't read it, including the GBC. Yeah.
Right. I haven't
read it. The BBC made a whole resolution against it, and none of them had read it at the time.
Okay, can you, in synopsize to me, without me reading, you know, like, you know, explain the gist of your...
Okay.
The reason... Why... Also, why did you write the book? Why did you feel it was necessary for someone as you, as a sannyasi, knowing it would be controversial, probably, because you... So those are all my questions, and then explain about it, okay. Because I haven't read it.
Okay. A major thrust of Srila Prabhupada's plan for establishing Krishna consciousness in the world was to establish Varnashram Dharma, Varnashram communities, and traditional Vedic culture and values. And if that had been done, maybe there would be a place for you and many others within this movement. If there was, because it means accommodating many, many people at many different levels.
Okay, so you have to. You also have to, by saying this as you're doing now, actually explain, because Varnashram Dharma, people have got many different concepts. So it'd be good if you define what you think about what it means. And what
it's there in Bhagavad Gita. It's there in Srimad Bhagavatam. People have different propensities. They have different. According to their previous karma, they get born in a certain situation, and often their psychophysical propensities follow the situation they're born in. Sometimes there are exceptions, but basically we find four kinds of people, and there should be hierarchical society based on that, cooperation, recognizing that people have different psychophysical natures, and that women are, talking on the material platform here, categorically different to men physically and psychologically. They have a very important function, which is giving birth to and nurturing children, which is not emphasized in modern society, rather the opposite. It's been rubbished that women who look after children are just stupid. So as a sannyasi, seeing that our movement has completely abandoned Srila Prabhupada's 50% of his work is to establish Varnashram, why Prabhupada said, to make a situation which is favorable for people to take to and practice Krishna consciousness. Completely abandoned. The GPC have nothing to say about it. They're doing nothing about it. Rather, they are bringing in policies which you're saying, I'm out of touch with the modern world. Yes, and I want to be out of touch in the sense that one reason I came to this movement, and I don't want to get so much into my past, but from a young age, as many people of our generation saw that this whole society that we're in is, it's soul killing. There's something at the intrinsically wrong with this society. So Srila Prabhupada wanted to establish a different kind of society so that people could swakarmanatam abhyacha siddhing vindati manavaha. So everyone, by following their propensity, can come by working in their particular position, they can worship the Supreme Lord and come to the ultimate perfection. So from the top level of our society, they have adopted what we can call is the present Western egalitarian outlook on society, which is actually the death knell for Western society, even materially speaking. If we see the...
What do you mean by that, egalitarian? Okay.
Egalitarian means the idea that everyone is socially equal. There should be no distinctions by race, age, sex, anything. It's trying to see everyone as equal in all respects, which is impractical and unrealistic.
Yeah, but I would say that most people who propound egalitarianism don't believe it. That's a kind of very kind of naive, simplistic, you know, interpretation of egalitarian. You know, it's basically, Bob Marley sings that song until
Wait a minute. I tell you what, before you interrupt, shall I finish my little...
Yes, okay, yeah, you do the whole thing and then I'll... Yeah.
Now, where was I? There are certain values in where, yeah, okay, this point that even materially it's the end of civilization when they bring in, when they start to undermine hierarchies, because societies work by hierarchy. There's a short book, the title of which I don't remember. It's called An Englishman by the surname Unwin, who wrote it in the 1950s. He analyzed, I didn't write this in this book, by the way, but he analyzed the history of civilizations, all different civilizations in the world. And in short, the book is, it goes like this. Bad times make strong men. Strong men make good times. Good times make weak men. And weak men make bad times. So what happens? I didn't put so much background in this book, Mothers and Masters, but I'm just giving some background of why even materially it's a egalitarianism or theoretical egalitarianism is a disaster. What happens is bad times make strong men. When people have to struggle, they become strong in their, maybe even physically, mentally. They come together, they work together to improve their society. So strong, bad times make strong men. People have ethics like hard work, cooperation, integrity, not cheating each other. And to improve our situation, we have to act morally. We can't just, if we're just acting for our own benefit, then we need to work together to improve our situation. So bad times make strong men, and people, then there's morals, there's togetherness, uprightness to lift the whole society up. So strong men make good times. And then when you become strong and you become stronger and you become a group, then you start to conquer other civilizations, like the Roman civilization, for instance. But then there comes a point, strong men make good times, then good times make weak men, because there comes a point when you are just born into luxury. I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth, like the 1960s hippies. They were born into luxury, which their parents had not been born into. into the American dream, the whites in America, which were the majority. So they were born into that. But so what happens is then they're born into that and they don't value the struggles that their and the values that their parents have. That, and so they say, I can have sex. I don't need to follow any virtues. What's the use of any virtue? And then they become weak. And then they don't want to do it. They don't want to work hard, which is the sign of a strong man. He works hard to build up the society. They don't want to work hard. They just want to indulge, but they're economically developed. So they bring in people from less or underlings, less developed civilizations who, and then they want to be all equal to them. And then they get overcome by the other civilizations and weak men make bad times. And then the whole thing collapses. That's it in Precy. So, where was it? So yeah, this idea that men and women should be completely equal in all respects. It wasn't promoted by Prabhupada. It's not promoted by Krishna. It's not promoted by Shastra. And that's another sign of this Unwin analyzed the down. I think the book's called The Downfall of Civilizations. That when women are given when it's considered that men and women should have the same roles and the same rights, that is a sign that the civilization is going to die. Because women, by their nature, are, as this guy has analyzed, they're not so much the team players or for building strong civilizations. They will, this has been analyzed, by the way, there are some YouTube videos which show that women cause the downfall of civilizations. And I did watch one of them. And just one thing sticks in my mind, that in they were showing in the Netherlands, when the Nazis invaded, there were plenty of women who were willing to, Dutch women, this is what they showed on the video. There are plenty of Dutch women who are willing to go along with the Nazis because they thought they're the strong men. The women gravitate towards strong men. So in this way, they won't maintain the civilization or a culture, or they'll go to whoever's strong. That is their tendency. This is no doubt anthropologists and sociologists and psychologists would take exception to this. It's a very simplistic depiction. But
yes, very much.
But you can read this book by Unwin. You can look it up. I think it's called The Downfall of Civilizations.
Well, I know.
But anyway, the way God made mankind, men have a certain role to play and women have a certain role to play. Men are supposed to protect women because they're supposed to have children and look after them, because generating. Oh, another thing is that when women get equal rights, then and the aim of society is for sense gratification, just enjoy yourself, then they don't have children, because having children means sacrifice. So in this way, the civilization gets outpopulated by the people they bring in to do all their dirty work, because the other people go on breeding. So and that's going on in the Western world now. The Western people are not populating because men and women don't want to make the sacrifice of having children and looking after them. And so the birth rates are going down. And this is nothing new. This is going on since time immemorial. So the role of men and women in society is different. It should be demarcated. Men have a more prominent social role. Women have a more subdued social role. And that's the way God made their psychophysical nature. And you can go against that and say, but when a society, we want equal rights, we want equal power. But actually in Vedic society, we want freedom, but there was very little freedom in Vedic society, actually. People had to follow so many rules. You have your duty. Dharma means duty. We say the women are not supposed to be independent, but the men, practically, they're not independent either because they're bound by so many duties. A man may be 60 years old, but as long as his father's alive, he can't make any independent decisions on any major matters. And that's been going on in India and many other cultures around the world till recently. So my book, I wrote that saying that, hey, look, this is what we should be doing. This is what our movement should be doing. Actually, the whole first part of the book was that book. The title was a bit of a hook, if you like, because that was discussed. But the first part of the book is why Prabhupada did want to establish Varnashram. It's been shoved under the carpet by our leaders, and they don't want to have anything to do with it, and this should be done. Now, another thing, anyway, there are many things in there. You can read it. That probably at the present time in the Western world, women and men have never been as discontent as they are at the present time. For all the progress and the freedom and all this kind of thing, people are very discontent. Whereas I believe the first ever world happiness survey was done in Bangladesh. They found that Bangladesh were the happiest people in the world. Nowadays, they do these happiness surveys and they find Finland is on top. But if you go to Finland, you find the people aren't happy. They've made the happiness survey according to what they think should make people happy, like having money, having free education, having equality of gender. But it's not actually on what people are feeling. It's just on what they think should make you happy. Although people in Finland are not happy. People in Bangladesh are more happy, actually, because they believe in God. They have family values. They have cohesion among people. People don't live for themselves. They have to live as part of a group. That's their culture. So that's a synopsis. And why did I write that book as a sannyasi? Because as a sannyasi is supposed to be the guru or the teacher of all the orders. And although I haven't officially taken a leadership role in ISKCON, unofficially I have as being a sannyasi. And I feel it's my duty when there's a major departure from what Srila Prabhupada taught and intended to point that out and show actually what people should be doing, what we should be doing if we're followers of Prabhupada. Another thing I wrote in that book is that, yeah, actually women are much happier when they're... How many days ago? Last Sunday. Was it Sunday? No, not Sunday. Anyway, about 3 days ago, I'm in a village in Tamil Nadu at the moment. We have outside one city where we have a project here. We're supposed to be building a temple. So just at the entrance to our property, there's a widow who's been living there. I've known her for years. So she came with her daughter who's just married, and the daughter's pregnant with her first child. And she had, I recognized the look on the face of the simple Indian woman pregnant with her first child look on her face. The look of bliss. I'm going to have my first child. Naturally, women are happy to have children. You see, they say it's by, what do they call it? Acculturation or something that boys play with cars and Lego and girls play with dolls. But you see in the villages in Bangladesh, you must have seen if you remember, when girls are 5 years old or younger, they start to pick up little babies, not the boys. The girls have that natural motherly instinct. And they feel happy like that. If they're well protected, they have children, they believe in God. That's, materially speaking, even the happiness for women, and people are like that. But I'm saying modern society, girls don't want to get married. Even if they get married, they don't want to have children. Even if they have children, they don't want to look after them. And then the children that do come out of these they come out of homes where the mothers and the fathers think the children are a burden. They want to kick them out as soon as they can. And in many cases, what is a family? It's completely disrupted. The mother's an alcoholic, and the father, if there is a father around, beats the mother, beats the kids. Maybe the mother beats the father also. That's a lot more common than is advertised, because men don't want to say that my wife beat me. They feel embarrassed. I'm basically saying we ISKCON, apart from our spiritual message, we have a very important material message. The world socially is in a total mess. We want to show how people can... When I went to Bangladesh, I was amazed at how people are living, how their relationships with each other, and how they don't have all these mental hang-ups that we have in our sophisticated Western society. They have their own things going on. But this is what Prabhupada, he was raised in this, and that's what he wants to establish. And that's what we as a society should be working toward establishing. That is the message of that book.
Okay. Well, thank you. I asked a heavy question and you gave quite a comprehensive answer. Now, as you were talking, I should have been taking notes, but I wanted to follow you. But one of the things that struck me about the conundrum of many of is okay, because we started to talk about, you kind of entered the thing about Vanashram Dharma. That was how you entered the discussion.
Yeah.
Now I was very much kind of like, after being a devotee for so many years, and that was one of the main things I discussed with Bhagavan. I discuss it when I was discussing in Bombay, and it was the reason, and I'd been thinking and I was asking him, I actually told him, I don't know if I use the exact phrases, but I said, ISKCON suffering from a kind of identity crisis. Because because there's various versions that I've been told what it is, since I've been, I could give it's a preaching movement. It's a Sankirtan movement. It's a movement to make Brahmins. It's a Vaishnav movement, and it's a Vanashram. And there's all these different things. And I said, but basically what has been going on is you just join this movement, get in a Sankirtan van and go out on the streets and sell books to get new people to join this thing. And there's no kind of like reflection or contemplation about, the actual kind of like, what are we going to do with everybody when they grow up, children?
It's called the ISKCON tube. You enter one end, you go along for some time, and you fall out the other.
Okay, so this is very important in this discussion that we're
and
having.
Therefore, Prabhupada wanted to establish Varnashram.
Okay, now let's just look at the reality of what it meant to be a devotee, okay, in the 70s. We joined this movement. Suddenly, we had to get a new temple. And with a new temple, there was big expenses moving from a garage to a big thing. What do you need? You need a bunch of guys going out there. And we started to sell records to get
more
money.
Don't moan, don't groan, just go out and pick the bone.
Yeah. So what happened was, people who may have had artistic tendencies and this and whatever your tendency was, out the window, jump in the Sankirtan track, get the money, because not only did you need the money to pay the bills, but as we gradually installed Gaudiya deities and Radha Krishna, you need a certain amount of Brahmins with second initiation to cook all the offerings, to do all the puja. So, and this was all happening just at the time when I joined, this expansion. And like I said, in Amsterdam, there was, and you were, we all put on saffron, a couple of people kind of got a weird, dodgy arranged marriages that never worked, mostly, you know. And so then people, we're all just kind of going along in this quite exoteric action, okay? Where, you know, the whole this mystical Hare Krishna thing and the bhakti, it's there, we're doing all our kirtan, but really it's all get the money, do this thing, this, we're part of this organization. Okay. Why? Because in the real world, not just the conceptual world of once upon a time in the Vedic culture when people did this and they did that, and Janaka, we're living in the kind of 70s, 80s, this world, in the Western world, transporting for the first time a tradition. And not only that, an interpretation of the tradition that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati set up as a monastic thing and the mutt. And then the reinterpretation of that, you know, because even, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's time, they didn't need to have farming communities because Bengal was a big farming community. I mean, villages are communities. You just actually had to kind of like imbibe Krishna and everything was there, the infrastructure. But in the West, but even if you go back to medieval times in Europe, it was kind of similar. But according to the time and place and circumstance of thing, which is what I want to keep track, which is very important, is we're not in the medieval period. We're not even in the kind of turn of the 20th century. The world, we were born into that baby boom generation. And the reason that America became the big skies is because they didn't get the Blitz and they weren't bombed out. You know, their whole kind of like, you know, we were devastated. The war was going on in Europe, not in America. So it flourished there. They, all the wealth developed, you know, and that's when the power in the world and the British Empire and the Commonwealth and everything went down. The, you know, we became very small. America became big. They became, you know, and then it's interesting because out of that society, you know, you had this incredibly, okay, you're talking about hierarchies and structures, you see, but if you would talk to critiques now of Western civilization and women, who are 50% of the population, they will say that, you know, criticizing the fact that civilizations all go wrong when women get involved is a bit of a thing, because men have been the ones that have been controlling it, and they're the ones that have created mostly the mess everywhere. It's the men. The women have been in the background. Funnily enough...
That's not in my book, by the way. I didn't put that.
Okay.
In.
But there's a time in history, it was weird, where I saw a program where there was this very famous abbot of a woman, a Christian in England.
Abbess?
Yeah, abbess? It was an abbess. And there was a Chinese queen, and there was, it's funny, I can't remember which century it was, and they both appeared, all three women, powerful women.
Were
appeared.
Very powerful, yeah.
Yeah, and then it was just a small little era, and then it kind of, it plummets when, and then, you know, you read all these stories. Okay, now, I've just been, I have a dear friend called Katinka, and she's from a very interesting family, but highly intelligent. I mean, she did her thesis on Plato and on medieval poetry and stuff in university. Her father started TEFL, teaching English with a foreign language. Her uncle had his own company, was an expert on Greek classics and stuff like that. So I associate with, and she is from that type of family. Not only that, she's you know, she can, so strong physically, she can hold me on her back, you know. My friend Anna, who was my landlady, I mean, incredible, a mother and physically out the garden and everything. This kind of misconception that, I mean, and when you go to, especially the Himalayas, and you go to the villages, the women do more work than the men generally, you know. And not only that, in this documentary that's most probably, I don't know if you've seen it, but the one on the road to Vrindavan by Ravenel Chambers, he goes into one village, I think it's in the Braj area, and it's, you know, all the girls from the Sandipani school, they all want to get educated and do this. But then the father, you see, in India, it's not about, you know, or even in Europe, in the world, marriage was not about romance. It was about economic and social contracts, you see. And so that's basically what people got together. And it was even up to the last century, but most people didn't have a time, except very aristocrats and people like that. They didn't have a time to mix. And so it's all to do with economic factors. It's all to do with economic factors. Now, like now, the reality is that actually to survive and pay rent and to do, you know, like living and getting an apartment in London is just so expensive that it actually kind of does take two members of the family to even get the money just to survive. That's, you know, and so you've got this economic now. That's just one of the factors to do with economics. Now, the thing is, Varnashram Dharma, okay? So to do what we did to ISKCON in the 70s, to maintain those temples and things, we had to kind of just go out there and sell records and all sorts of, and then it turned into scamming. And then that's what happened in ISKCON. ISKCON got involved in all these projects. They couldn't sustain it. And then they started to get into the Rajasic quick fix mode. Let's go out there, guess, get money, do these things. And then it all kind of all got a bit topsy turvy. And then in the background of all of that was post Prabhupada was all the weird egos of all the 11 gurus who, you know, so you had this whole very, very socially dysfunctional organization with very extreme high ideals, but totally dysfunctional and unable to even focus on those ideals or implement them, you know, because within all of it, you had some egomaniacs who were kind of using and manipulating devotees. There was all sorts of strange things going on around the world. You know, I'm specifically thinking of New Vrindavan at the moment, but there was that. So then you've had this problem. Now, there's a couple of communities around the world that are reasonably successful, but this, you know, to actually leave a city, okay, and to go and establish yourself on a plot of land in a community of devotees and, you know, live sustainably and all of that, which is what I think that you're talking about with the kind of the Varnashram community. It's such a massive thing that they, you know, to be able to do it is a very complex. The reason it hasn't happened is because of a lot to do with economics. And like, you know, like now Bhaktivedanta Manor, why does it work? Because it's got lots of Hindus who are all living and they're all integrated into society with jobs and money and they're business people and they donate money. They're not kind of from, you know, hippie backgrounds and things like that. And they've got totally different relationship with Krishna consciousness. And it's not all about just living in the temple anymore. It's all about the temple being a kind of a training place or a central temple. I suppose I've covered, I'm alluding to the complexity of imagine people are meant to suddenly, from the Western world that we live in 2021, because there are many, many devotees and people in the bigger picture who would love to get out of the rat race and actually live in community. There's, you know, lots of people I know with them, especially now with COVID and everything. People are really kind of like, you know, Babylon's going down, man, you know, let's get out to, you know, but how to do it, because it's all involves economics and money. And then you've got all these other social issues involved, you see. And just one more point. You're about the hierarchies, but I don't know if you've ever read the books of M. Scott Peck, but he's got this book called The Different Drum About Community, and then another book called The World Waiting to Be Born. And he says there's certain psychological types that work very, very well under authoritarian dynamics. In other words, an authority up here and arrows going down to loads of people below. But some people cannot stick that. You know, they have to work in what's called participative dynamics, more egalitarian, you know, and it doesn't mean that the leader has to, you know, it's about people who are actually leaders are actually servants. This is actually the moral of the quandary, is that somebody who actually takes on the role of a leader in society actually is the best servant. And even, funnily enough, Hermann Hesse came to that conclusion, the German writer. And that's the whole moral of his allegory called Journey to the East, if you ever want to read it. It's fantastic. It takes about 4 hours. It's a work of genius. And the whole meaning of that book is the servant is the master. And that's the problem that happens in the corruption of hierarchical techniques and the fact that there's been revolutions and the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution and people revolt is because the top heavy hierarchy actually doesn't work unless the leader is a kind of benign dictator. If there's a benign dictator, but the thing is, these kind of like things that have to come in place for, you know, a kind of community to manifest. It's very complex in this year time, in this at the moment, you know, to achieve those things that you are talking about.
Okay. I'm aware of the things you've said. It's definitely true, all you say. It's very complex. There are many, many issues. But my point is that we have been given a mandate by Srila Prabhupada, and at the very least, we should start considering about what to do. We shouldn't just go along. It's just like we've surrendered to the modern society, and we're just going to become part of it instead of being a solution and an alternative to the modern society. We've decided to go along with it, just like I saw on Dandavats, which I don't often visit, but I saw there was a condolence letter to the royal family because Prince Philip had died. So it's, you know, we're part of the establishment trying to become kowtow to the establishment. And I'm not saying that we should have like that kind of French Revolution kind revolutionary mood or anarchism or any such thing. But our movement at the present time is trying to position itself as an acceptable minority religion within the values of Western society.
Movement, do you mean ISKCON?
Yes.
Or do you mean?
I mean okay. ISKCON. Yeah.
Okay. It's very limiting then when you say that.
Yeah,
because
okay.
Sorry to butt in, because like say if you just imagine in England.
But I'm writing for ISKCON. This book, Mothers and Masters, is written primarily for ISKCON. What is the direction of our movement? There may be so many others who are doing so many other things.
Yeah.
But I'm writing this for what is the direction of our movement? De facto, without any discussion, or at least it's become, we're positioning ourselves, like I say, as please allow us to exist and we'll go along with all your values. We're not everything. We're not vegetarian. We're vegetarian. So we're not for the slaughter industry, but at the same time, we're not going to protest much about it. And more or less we've got our niche within that. So my point is that we as a movement, Prabhupada gave us something much bigger and better to do. It's easier to just go with the flow, but the flow is going to hell and we're supposed to be making something better. At the very least, we should recognize that we're supposed to be doing that, and we should be at the very least discussing what we should be doing to move in the way that Prabhupada wanted. But actually, we can do it. It is possible today to set up communities with Krishna in the center, growing our food. Okay, for city people to come to the country, it may not be very easy, but there are plenty of people who have in the Western world who have no interest in Krishna consciousness, maybe never even heard of it, who are doing that, who are leaving the cities, going to the country, growing their own food, maybe hunting elk, but they've come out of the big city life and they want to live simply in the country without even any spiritual values whatsoever. So it can be done. Yeah. As far as when I say hierarchy, the words hierarchy and authority, they are almost pejorative terms in English language for many people. Mm. Probably due to, there's distrust of authority, and rightly so. But in Vedic culture, and at the present time in India, and probably in China and so many places, Japan definitely, Asian culture in general, probably in Africa, and it was there in the West also until fairly recently, authority figures were not looked down on as being necessarily exploitive or people to be rebelled against. If we see now Ram Nomi is coming up, that's the example. The king was considered himself an agent of God, like you say, the servant leader, who was ruling to protect the citizens like a father toward the children, and the citizens naturally reciprocated with that. So we tend to think of leadership as being oppressive, but it doesn't have to be like that.
No, it doesn't have to be, but it is right. One of the you're in modern times, and stories of that.
Why we have to be in these communities. We have to keep Krishna consciousness in the center. Everyone has to come together and do kirtan, have lots of kirtan together, keep Krishna in the center. Mm. It is possible, at least here in India, I'm overseeing some communities, pilot projects. One of them has been going on for about 15 years. We have devotees from the city who decided, I don't want to raise my children in this society. It's successful, earning good money, but they decide, I don't want to raise my children like this. Let's start a farm. There's no farm community. Okay, let's start one. And they're doing it. And lots of struggles, but they've done it. They've made the transition. And others are coming and joining. So, it's important that all the devotees come together and they do kirtan twice a day together, minimum twice a day together. That's very, very important to keep Krishna in the center and live as simply as possible. Even the leaders of the community are there, but they live as simply as everyone else. Mm-hmm. It requires a high standard of spiritual aspiration I want this for myself and my family. I want to live like this because my aim is Krishna. I want to go to Krishna. And if I live in the city, I'm going to have to work. I have to spend most of my time with people who have no spiritual aspirations. And I have to live according to their culture to a large extent. So it's a conscious decision. It can be done. At least
have those communities that you said you oversee, were they the result of you giving these kind of talks about these things?
And then
they got inspired and you encouraged them. Yeah. But did they actually sit together and amongst themselves and decide we want to live like this, or have you been guiding, have they been consulting with you right from the beginning, and it's the kind of your brainstorm in a sense?
We meet regularly, and I leave it to we discuss so many things. Actually, I have a whole series of talks on our projects and how they're going along. One of them is called Sailing into Uncharted Waters. That's one of the talk's names, because it's something new for us and how to organize a society. The farming bit isn't the difficult thing, actually. People think, oh, farming, it's so difficult. But all over the world, when you say a farmer, generally you think of someone who's not very educated. It doesn't require a big brain. It does require some skills and expertise. But by Krishna's grace, the land in many parts of the world gives profusely food. So the farming part, that's not... The really difficult part, or the more difficult part, is getting everyone together, keeping them together. And for that, focused, we'll be here because we want to serve Krishna. We want to keep Krishna and doing kirtan together. And the leaders are very important. They have to have a mood of like that, of being, as you say, in a mood of service. So we do. It's not that I've said, it's not my style of working at all, that we say, you must do this. We discuss, and usually I say, well, you make the decision based on, you're there, but I will give this idea. Prabhupada said this, traditional culture is like this. And then some of them, they're doing much, much research on traditional systems, what Shastra says, So it's a group effort, you could say. Oversee means I'm not there most of the time. I do spend time there. I haven't since okay. COVID began.
Something just occurred to me while you were I'm envisioning, because I saw that one little video of that one community, you know, where they got the, you know, it's incredible. The devotees walking barefoot on the fields, kind of throwing seeds out. I mean, it really is old fashioned. It could be from any age. That could be an illustration from some kind of ancient cave in India, from a culture thousands of years ago. Somebody with a cloth throwing grain, walking barefoot. You know, that talk about simple living. Okay. Varnashram Dharma, which is what you were saying, you know, it's about everybody working according to their Dharma. So this is one of the complexities of what I've heard of discussions online from other people who've, you know, there's various reasons why the communities in the West didn't work. It's because, you know, basically they got to feed their kids and got to get a job because they're, first of all, they maybe at that community, they didn't have proper educational facilities, you know, so they had to go outside of the community to make the money.
Excuse me, Mathura Prabhu, we get into the details, we could be speaking for hours and hours and hours. And with the devotees that I'm involved with, we have spoken for hours and hours and hours. And we go on speaking what to do, how to do.
Right.
There are so many details.
I suppose it's the link between farming and the whole idea of everybody. It's like, say, if you're an artist.
It's not that everybody's a farmer. In any society at any time, the majority of people are not farmers. Most people will have a kitchen garden for growing their vegetables, and they may have a few cows, but the actual, the heavy duty farming is done by a few people.
So the idea is to merge two ideas of a Vedic living lifestyle with the actual social package of Varnashram. That's
Okay. So my point is that as a society, we should not have neglected Prabhupada's order. We should have done this. Failure to do that means that we have de facto or by force of necessity, we have merged back into the broader society with all its problems, like you have to work hard to make money, and it's the money culture. I call it it's a culture which is based on money, and everyone has to think of money, and most people are in anxiety about money.
Well, it is true. You can't avoid it. I mean, basically, I one time
but
on
that's
train,
what I'm saying. We as a society should be working toward establishing a society in which you can avoid it, that people don't have to be in anxiety all the time.
I know.
We should be doing that for the benefit not only of our devotees, but for setting an example for the whole world and let people come and join.
It's basically what the problem of what happened with ISKCON, you know, it became obsessed with fundraising. You know, fun fundraising, which became, you know, like hitting people up, and this whole kind of like the whole kind of vision became about getting, you know, funds to pay for things. You know, when it comes down to it, it's like, I've got a flat here. It's, you have to live somewhere and you have to pay rent for it wherever you live in the world, you know. So
not necessarily if you're on one of our farms, you don't have to pay rent.
No, but who owns the land? Who bought it?
It's a trust.
Okay.
We have trust. We get the fund? Yeah, we also need funds like anything. But we're not sending people out on the pick. We would love if people give, because buying land is very expensive in India.
Exactly, yeah.
But we have... Everything. Yeah. What can you... You just can't flick a switch and go to Varnashram.
Exactly.
We should be... Again and again, I'm saying we should be moving toward that.
Okay, yes.
And
yes,
I think
okay.
a lot of the antipathy toward myself and others who speak on this is because devotees think, well, I'm out of touch with the world. This is our real life. We have to live like this. But I'm saying... what I'm saying is, I'm very sorry you have to live like that. But we, at least the leaders of this society, should be working toward making a society in which your children at least won't have to live like that. We should be doing, we as the leaders, I mean, I'm talking about myself, I guess you're all part of it. So, but we should be doing that.
Except that the majority of people aren't in ISKCON. They're all outside.
Okay, but let ISKCON, those who have come together within ISKCON for these, with the ideal of being Krishna conscious and serving Prabhupada's mission, should do this and effect Prabhupada's mission. That's what I'm saying. And for you, if you want to join at some point, that's up to you. It's up to you.
But it's most probably only going to happen with young people, you know?
We want younger people on our farms, those who can work hard and have children.
Yeah,
they can work hard and have children.
Both you and me are single, but most people I know of our age, you know, mid-60s on, they're grandparents. They're all grandparents.
That's what I'm saying. It's not... We have to see how to move from the situation we're in now to the situation that Prabhupada envisaged. And first of all, we have to come to some kind of consensus on what Prabhupada envisaged. But I'm not waiting for the GBC. I'm doing whatever I can in my little sphere of influence to start that. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, we have some communities.
Yeah.
We're trying to do that. We're trying to do it.
You have one in, you said, mentioned in Czechoslovakia, was it, or Europe
In Czech Republic, there's a.
So what is going? What's happening there?
Same thing. Devotees are coming together. They're living on the land. They're chanting Hare Krishna.
Okay.
I'd love to do it everywhere. Why just me? It should be the whole society. Yeah.
So this is basically with a group of devotees there, the Czech Republic, who. You've met, they've become attached to you. Are they your disciples? Would you say they're your disciples?
Yeah, about half of them are in that community. Maybe a little more than half.
How many people are there in that community?
There are not that many. I think there are about five or six couples. And there will be more joining. We're talking about families here.
I'm not such a
misogynist that I'm saying people shouldn't have. And I mean, it's nonsense, actually.
I suppose it's just to kind of just to clarify. It's not a monastery for monks. It's a community.
No.
Yeah.
The farms are primarily. There'll be kids who will be brahmacharis and young girls. And but they're mostly for grihasthas. That's all. The society is always going to be mostly grihasthas, right?
Yeah.
It makes sense, doesn't it? It's just real. It's realism. So we have to, if our Hare Krishna movement, ISKCON, is going to be more than just some temples that people come to, then we need to make communities where people can live in such a way that people can think of Krishna 24 hours a day, which is not possible for our many grihastha devotees at the present time. It's very difficult for them to do so. When you go to work, the boss wants you to think about his work. He doesn't want you to think about Krishna. So you might have a picture of Krishna on your desk, but your mind has to be on whatever you're doing for the boss or for the company. Yeah. But if you live in a Krishna conscious community, everything is centered around Krishna and you're living with devotees and they all have tilak and it's so much easier to be. The physical difficulty might be there more, but the spiritual facility is incomparable. If you go there, you'll see. I'll tell you one thing. When we first started our first community, there were three. We started a project. We said we'll do 5 years with just three couples, three families, young families. But actually, after about 2.5 years, they thought it's working. Let's expand. And then because many people wanted to join them. When they got the land, they'd build their little houses, they'd started, and I hadn't been there. So I came and I saw the devotee who was leading up the project. And I said to him, young Grihastha at the time, he's not so young now, I said to him that your face has become black and it's become bright. Black because he's not in an office all day, he's out in the sun. And in India, it's damn hot right now. Getting up to the hottest, next month is the hottest month of the year. So your face is black and it's bright because he was a very serious devotee before he moved to the land and all in the city also, but he was working in an office all day, every day. But his face had become bright because he's living with devotees. He's chanting Hare Krishna twice a day, kirtan with all the devotees. So it's actually a fact. Devotees become so, if it's not all of them, some of them, they move and they can't adjust. And then they move out again. But those who stick it out, they become very happy because Krishna consciousness makes you happy. If we're living together with devotees and chanting Hare Krishna, we become happy. And they feel it's worth giving. Those who are there, they feel it's worth giving up the comforts of the city to leave. Now on the farms, it's very hot and we don't have electricity there as a principle, because if you have electricity, then you're going to have electric lights and you're going to be up to 11 o'clock at 12 o'clock at night.
They don't have Wi-Fi.
I think they have two phones for the whole community for communication outside.
How do they charge them up if they're no?
They have a little charging station. They do. They have an office also for communication with the outside world. But in the houses, in the temple, there's no electricity, which means there's no people. They don't have gadgets. And then when you have a gadget, you always want to get the latest and the best and the newest.
Yeah.
And there's no end to it. And then you have to generate more money to get that. And you can't get that if you're living just on the land. And electricity is the downfall of everything. So it's very austere.
Yeah.
But devotees are happy. But then people have lived like that for centuries. People have lived there. There was no electricity. There was no electric current online for...
I just thought that's just sort of thing. In England, there's a lady living in the woods with like that. She's been off grid. She's been doing that. And you know,
not off grid is one thing, but no electricity is something else.
No.
Off grid means you get solar or something like that. But this is not just off grid. This is no electricity.
I don't think she even had. Yeah, I think she was absolutely nothing. I think she was absolutely anyway. Yeah, but that's fantastic. I mean, I saw that little, it was very touching. I just thought, my goodness, you have to be very, very dedicated. But again, these things only work in certain climates as well. And certain, you know, it can't work everywhere. Or in the same way, there's obviously going to be slightly different.
Oh, definitely in England, you're going to have, it's going to be tougher because of the long, cold winter. But you do have a long growing season in England still.
Yeah. Yeah,
whereas in Russia, it's the growing season is only a few months a year. That makes it really tough.
Something I just wanted, before I forget it, is because I just watched this video that Rota Vrindavan, which is all about women in India, and they've got statistics, you see. So before you were kind of painting quite an idealistic view of how women are in India and in the villages, but the statistics are that a huge amount of women are just abused in India, you know, and young, and they're married. I mean, anyway, there's statistics about it's like worse than the West, you know. So it's easy to criticize the West and their Western system, but the thing is, what they're the people who are proponing like education, they're saying that the only way that women can get themselves out of this kind of like continuous position of being abused by abusive men, because the men aren't all protective and nice and lovely and stuff. There's and relatives, and not only that, in India, one of the things I noticed is that, like you said, it's all about the family. It's a very, very, but what there's a certain, again, there's economic reasons for it, you see.
Yeah. That's why we have to put Krishna in the center, not money in the center. Money is the love of money is the root of all evil, east or west. And one thing I'll say about women in India, Yeah, they have, no doubt they have difficulties, but they do have a family and they do have security in the future. And they don't die unknown, unloved in some nursing home.
No, but they could get dumped. They could get dumped in if they're Bengalis, they could dump their grandma in Vrindavan and say, bye. Yeah. No, what I mean to say is it's going on in various different ways in both cultures.
So therefore we want to have ideal Krishna conscious communities in which everyone is important, and not just the humans, the animals, the plants. Yeah. It's all part of God's creation. We want to set an ideal.
Yeah.
An ideal standard. But I must say what I saw in Bangladesh, because like that, we were traveling around, we were living among Bengali families, we saw how they lived, and yeah. It was very impressive to me.
Yeah.
Very impressive. Yeah. Now, things may be changing because of the money culture. Now, India is also a money culture. It's a consumer society, and that changes. Yeah. The love of money is the root of all evil, said Lord Jesus Christ, as you know very well. So that does contaminate everything, and people become selfish and they want more and more things for themselves. And then there's soft and hard pornography pushed everywhere. And then people's lusty desires are, and then when you become grossly lusty like that, you become a Satan. You can do all kinds of horrible things. So instead of protecting women, you're seeing them as sex objects, exploiting their bodies. It's horrible. Actually, yeah. No one's even talking about it, but the whole world.
But that's where feminists would agree with you.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. The governments everywhere, they should get together and stop. Why do they allow this pornography, which is exploiting women? And it's dragging people's consciousness down, and then you get people who are just completely lusty, and then there's rape, and the pornography should be stopped, and human trafficking should do whatever they can to stop human trafficking.
Yeah, well,
they should find all the human traffickers and just finish them off. It's evil. Of course, that's an Abrahamic religion concept of evil. But if there's anything evil, it's human trafficking. It's horrible. They should stop. So, I mean, there's such bad. Practically, I can't discuss with feminists because we come from such a different understanding of how society should be. And they can't imagine that there can be people who live in a non-exploitive society. They just can't imagine it. And they think that they have to get on top of the pile and push the men down, and we have to show our strength. But it doesn't have to be like that. Women have their strength naturally, but they're subtly. But that's not allowed that's to also, develop now.
That's so a kind of extremes feminism. There's also
feminism that the extremists are the one who make the most propaganda.
They had a very interesting.
But basically, feminism, whatever it is, the materialistic society is on a wrong basis. First of all, people should understand. That's why we need the book distribution and the festivals and the public preaching and the temples to preach these things. That first of all, people should understand that we are born again and again and again. Reincarnation is a fact. And that this life that we have, this human life, is meant not just for living and enjoying yourself, but it's meant for God realization. And then on that basis, then we can begin to understand why we have a society based on that, and that why different men have different roles and women have different roles. That's why I say it's at a completely different approach to society and to understanding everything. So we need the outgoing preaching. We need the ISKCON book distribution. And we need all these things to be established. And then on the basis of that, we can understand why we need to establish a completely different way of life, which is not based on personal needs per se, whereas the whole society works as a cohesive unit with the leaders, that means the intellectual leaders and spiritual leaders, brahmanas, and the kshatriyas, The majority of people may not have a very clear idea about what this is all about.
But when we on our
leaders,
last talk,
the leaders should know.
Well, on our last talk, when we, I think I mentioned the word unity. You know, I think you shook your head quite a lot. I remember because, okay, I'm listening to you, and I think many people would agree with lots of things that you're saying as ideals. Really,
yeah, but they don't believe it can be done, and I believe it can be done.
Okay,
and it should be done, and at least we should try to do it. And those who are willing, let them come along and do it.
Yeah, well, I'd be nice if
Prabhupada was an idealist, and but he believed it could be done by Krishna's grace, and we should do that also.
Yeah,
Krishna can do it.
I suppose it's the fact that trying to get the unity of things together to people, because as you're talking about the movement, you're talking about, you said it needs the leaders and this and that, but even to get to the point where people kind of feel unified, you know, like in the, you know, feel part of the same thing, because at the moment it's all fragmented everywhere. Yeah. The world has actually become more fragmented.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
You know, I mean, I'm an old hippie. I write at the end of all my things, peace and love, peace and love. I'm into peace and love. But, you know, and I'm a kind of friendly, nice guy, and I'm kind of not too left wing and not right wing. I'm somewhere left of center, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, even with one's, if I have to admit it, even with one's best friends that one spends a lot of time with, it's not, you know, there's, you know, nearly, in fact, all of my good friends who I've spent time with doing things, we all love each other. But when you work together with time, especially when you put time together on collaborative projects, money, emotions and stuff, comes a point where your differences, like in relationships, you know, somebody has one idea, somebody has another idea, and then there's some kind of tension or whatever it is. And then there's a kind of a desire to kind of like revert back into one's own space. It's like, I have my own flat here. I'm a single guy. It's great. It was like a revelation. I don't have to deal with anybody's trips or anything, because I do what I want, basically. And so the idea of even, because I've thought about the community thing for a long time and desired it and craved it and different things and still do, but see so many obstacles. That was another thing that you brought up in one of your talks. Obstacles, obstacles, it's all obstacles. So unity, and what are the obstacles? And these are the things I don't have answers for. It's about, we have, Prana wrote a song, you know, he says, why can't we live together? We're supposed to be family, all loving one another. You're my sister, my brother. And then he goes, there's a question to ask yourself. And he said, do we really want to get along? We stand divided by our prejudice, but when we're united, we're so strong. We all know that when unity creates strength, but somehow or other, everything seems to have a tendency to fragment off, even
therefore, vyavasaya atmika buddhi ekeha kuru nandana. Yeah, and if we're going to make this change in the world, then we have to be united on one principle. And the principle and the mission, we have to take that as more than our own personal desires and prejudices. And we have to have faith in the leadership also, those who are leading it, that they're leading us with a good vision and with a good heart. And that's very difficult to establish now. That's a fact. Right. But again, we should try. And I can say this, that at least the projects I'm overseeing in India, the devotees, they're doing it with faith in what I'm teaching them. But it's also faith that what I'm saying is in line with what Prabhupada wanted. That's very important. That is not just me, but it's what Prabhupada wanted. And also with the faith that comes from living like that and finding that, hey, I'm becoming happy. It works. Krishna consciousness works. So that faith is generated like that. Again, before we started these projects, I was talking about it and everyone was saying, no, you can never do that. People will never come together. They'll never live austerely. You can't do it. We don't hear anyone saying that anymore. People thought it was impossible, but now it's been going on for almost one generation now. And we don't hear people saying anymore, at least in India, it can't be done.
Mm.
Let's see, everything, the time and the influence of Kali Yuga is very strong. Everything,
so how many projects in India do you have?
Everything could be finished in a second. I have one which has been going on for about, let me see, about how long? 12 years in Gujarat. The one that you saw the video of, I think that's quite new. That's only about 2 years in Andhra Pradesh, but it had a precursor to it also, which went on for a few years. But that's the precursor project was full of problems. We shifted to another place and changed the whole place, and things are going much better there. There's a pilot project in Punjab where they're only at the moment brahmacharis, because the idea is the brahmacharis set up everything, make the buildings, everything. Then the grihasthas will move in. Well, COVID came instead. So that hasn't really, because of COVID. And then there's another one down here in Tamil Nadu, which farming is going on, but there isn't really a community. It's not an easy thing. And you have, there are so many factors to require. There was another one in Karnataka, which looked very promising, but then the whole place flooded out and everything was destroyed and devotees haven't gone back. So there we have, we could say we have three communities working, another one which is very promising being established. So yeah, we could say three and a bit. And I'm very interested to get this one in Tamil Nadu going, but it seems.
You know Mahamsa? He used to be Mahamsa Swami.
Yeah. He was there.
I visited. He's got a lovely place down in Kodai called Karuna Dham.
Kodai Canal.
I visited that 18 years ago, but we've reconnected again. And when I go back to India, I'm going to check it out. It's a small, devoted community, eco yoga thing going on there.
But I don't think it's really a community, is it?
It is a community. It's called Karuna Dham. It's got its own, dynamics and stuff. I don't know all the details. You can check out their webpage. I don't know if you've got enough. There was just one point I wanted to bring up. I don't know if maybe we can cover it. Is the because we started with Chaitanya Charitamrita, we went into some quite esoteric areas, you know. So I have to admit, there was this little book written by our god brother who kind of changed his name, you know, that kind of did the rounds for a while, Gadadhar Pran Pandu, you know, and it was called Why Did Lord Chaitanya Come?
Yeah, Gauranagari.
No, it's not Gauranagari. That book is not. That's something else. It's called Why Did Lord Chaitanya Come and What Did He Come to Give? That was the book, okay. Mm-hmm. And I happened to just arrive in Mayapur at that time when he had finished that book, and I read it. And it was interesting. And that book did a lot of the rounds around ISKCON and got to people like Tamal and Shivaram and lots of different people. And I think that that's what was part of the thing that instigated that whole kind of interest that they had with esoteric Vaishnavism. So my
Kushakrata's translations also, they made that available, widely available for the first time in English.
But the thing that he made, the point about that little book was, he was trying to make a point that this was his point in that book, whatever.
It's all there in Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Yeah, it's like his point was, look, you've done all this Vaidhi Bhakti for all these years, you've been trained in ISKCON, you've done it all, like, you follow, you know, very good. But is that all there is to it? You see, that's his point, you see. So I suppose my point is that there's, all the stuff that we were just talking about is with Gauranga Mahaprabhu is the esoteric internal part of his. See, as the Yuga avatar, he's come to instigate the congregational chanting of the holy name. And that's the kind of exoteric raison d'etre.
But the exoteric and the internal, they coalesce, because chanting the holy names is also the means to attain Krishna Prem.
Exactly. But
I give an analogy with music because I've been around the music scene for a while. Okay. So you want to, you hear Ravi Shankar playing and you go, wow, it's incredible. I want to do it. I want to be like him. So you go to Ravi Shankar and you say, oh, Guruji. And he tells you, okay, first you have to sit like this, you know, and you're going, oh, goodness, I'm not used to that. And then you do this. And then you've got to learn these things called notes, and you've got to tune the instrument. You've got to go, sa re ga ma pa da ni, you know. And then the student's sitting there, and he's going, but Guruji, I don't want to do all this. I want to just do rag, like you play, with full abandon, you know. And
it's interesting. Goes, the word point is, the word rag is there in both spheres, isn't it?
Exactly. That's the reason I'm using it, because then the teacher, because I've been around all these family traditions as well in Varanasi, you know, where they're like 6, 7, 8 generations of family musicians, you see. So what will happen is like even Zakir Hussain was saying, as a child, he used to wake up at 2:15 in the morning to practice for like 12 hours a day. And and then only then, when they've got to a certain point, the guru will let them play, because the whole point of the music is not to go, it's actually to play a raga. The ultimate goal of the music is to play a raga. It's basically you learn a technique, but this technique is not the end in itself. It's a means to an end. Like even driving a car, you learn how to drive a car, and then afterwards you forget it, but you don't think about it. You just do it, you know? So this isn't my point. And that the sadhana is like riyas. They use that word riyas. You have to do, you don't just automatically get to the raga. So my point, I suppose, is there's been, while in establishing Gaudiya Vaishnavism into an institution that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati did, I was researching kirtan and all of these different things in Calcutta, not knowing the literature. And then I discovered that there was this big gap, and lots of things that weren't happening in the Gaudiya Math had been kind of like censored and edited out, even to the point of like certain songs by Narottam, like Radha Krishna Pranamore. We sing the first few verses, but not the others. And then anyway, I suppose my point is about this, and it's become a conundrum now in the whole kind of Vaishnava world. And that's why some people leave ISKCON and they go off to Babaji's, or they go to Goswami's, and or whatever it is because it's, seems that the institution, which naturally has to be, is founded on Vaidhi, but the goal of the tradition is rag. It's how, and then also as you're talking about Varnashram Dharma, very roots, getting everyone rooted to a kind of civilized human platform to be able to progress to these highfalutin. I sometimes go, wow, we've got this such as, I mean, talk about esoteric philosophy. I mean, we've got the esoteric kernel within the kernel within the kernel of if you're thinking of Vedic, you know, knowledge. And that's what Brihad Bhagavatamritam does. But Brihad Bhagavatamritam is a literature written on the level of Sambandha. So it's, the Ishtadevata of Sanatana Goswami is Madan Mohan, who is he attracts you. It's literature on Sambandha, whereas these other literatures, which are considered taboo, many of them, but by Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharyas, are the Prayojana, you see. So there's a complex conundrum that's appeared now in the tradition, and it's going to affect people in the coming years as it develops, is this, how are people to reconcile the esoteric with the exoteric, and what's valid and what's not valid, really. I mean, there's loads of devotees who are kind of, our God brothers who are involved with this all over the place, you know, in India, in part of this sect or that sect or independent, and they're deeply involved in that, what they believe is the next stage of their bhakti. They're not really thinking about Varnashram Dharma. These are all devotees who've been there, done that, their grandparents, they're all doing, got their deities, their pujas, their reading, and they're believing that now we need to practice rag bhakti sadhana. We've done the Vaidhi bit.
Have they?
I don't know. I'm just asking. This is what they are saying. They say, because, well, I've been chanting Hare Krishna for 50 years.
Because I see that the way most devotees in the world live today, they don't have time to do proper sadhana anyway.
It's different people
if you see, just like, for instance, the Babajis or even strict householders in India, they used to follow very strictly and spend hours and hours every day doing sadhana. Yeah. I'm talking about rules, vaidhi. In Raghunuga Bhakti, you also follow vidhi. You follow some. Yeah. Yeah, they're very, very strict. Even the water they drink, what to speak about the food they drink, they don't just go out and buy a loaf of bread and put some butter on it and eat it. You have to cook it and offer it to Krishna. They're very strict in following the rules.
But so there's a mixture, but there are some devotees out there.
Yeah, great. Good for them.
They've been worshipping their deities for years. Great.
Good for them. All glories to them. Okay. Great. But someone has to take the mantle which Prabhupada gave also. I'm not saying what they're doing is outside of what Prabhupada gave, but Prabhupada also had a vision for the whole world, that others can also have this opportunity to come to this platform.
So what in your vision, okay, or your, how do you see, because I don't know, I'm in the middle of all of this, and I'm not a great sadhaka at all, so I'm not really, but I'm watching this develop around me as a phenomena, because it's part of the culture. And I often wonder because as ISKCON develops and people go through their practices for years, where is the point where it becomes really relevant, all these esoteric
aspects? It's an individual thing, isn't it? It's going to be an individual thing. Shivaram Swami wrote about this in one of his books, The Life of a Devotee. It's how he goes through the whole ISKCON process, and then gradually Krishna reveals himself to the devotee and he goes up to higher levels. It's Atashri Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Graham Indraya Sevon Mukhe Hijivado Swayameva Spirati Ada. By serving Krishna, Krishna reveals himself. There comes a point where it starts to happen. In everyone's
so mind. Yes, it is a very so basically that is what is going to happen or is happening, is that different people will gravitate towards
but it's generally not a thing to be advertised also.
No, absolutely, I agree.
And that's Satan Chaitanya Charitamrita also, that externally one will go on with one's sadhana and internally one will cultivate so many things. And some things may come out also. People write books. Shivaram Swami's writing his books. Clearly in his heart, Krishna is manifesting. The pastimes of Vrindavan are manifesting. He's writing it in books for those. But you see in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's books also, just like Chaitanya Shikamrita, he starts off even very, very basic moral level, and then he comes up to the theistic moral level, goes step by step. And there comes a point in Chaitanya Shikamrita, in Jaiva Dharma, there comes a point where he goes up to the esoteric stuff. But he also says, in his songs also, he says, just like at the end of his Shikshashrika songs, he says one song, this song is only for those who have the Adhika. So he's put it in writing, but he said, this is not for everyone. Only if you have the proper Adhika, you can enter it. It's there, but it's not for everyone. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, for instance, has written for beginners or even pre-beginners and gone all the way up to the very, very highest levels. But he says, this, for those who have the adhika, for those who are eligible, they can take this. Others will certainly misunderstand. And that's there. There's nothing new in our sampradaya. That's been there since the beginning. That they're levels of eligibility. It's just that Bhaktisiddhanta, well, beginning with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, actually, and then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati took it up very strongly, seeing that there are many people who are imitating and misusing the esoteric stuff, and no one's, in the name of rag, no one's doing their saragama panadita. they're not doing it. They're not. Then they just, they think they're doing rag, but anyone who actually knows what rag, can you imagine someone just picks up a sitar and they try to imitate? It'll be, to them, it may sound like Ravi Shankar, but to anyone who's studied even Saregama Panida, it'll sound terrible. So that's what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati saw. So he wanted to get it on a more realistic footing.
No, I totally understand that. There's just one more point I wanted to make. I didn't, at that time when I read the Brihadbhagavatamritam, it wasn't Krishna Karanamrita that I read as well. It was Jivadharma. That was the other book that was there.
Oh, I
actually
see.
Didn't read Krishna.
Because I remember we had in our library in Dhaka the Jyoti Maharaj's edition from Madras, yeah. Gauriamat, Krishna Karanamrita. Yeah. Krishna Karanamrita and Jivadharma. Those two books were there.
Yeah.
But you just read the Jivadharma.
I read, well, they were Vyasakis copies at that time.
And Brihadbhagavatamrita. Yeah, that was there. Yeah. They were all from Madras, Gauriamat.
Exactly. I read Jivadharma. But that's another story as well. Anyway, I think that we've discovered quite a lot of ground.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah. And it's bedtime for me.
Yeah. Anyway, look, thank you so much. I'm going to ask you some quite big questions. And I think that's made it clear, maybe for many people who are listening as well. And
are you doing this also on your Facebook thing also? No,
I actually, what I do is, when you've edited it and sent it to me and I've gone over it and then you put it up on YouTube.
Oh, okay. Like last time. Okay, fine.
Yeah, then I take a, no, I'm not going to put it now, only the finished copy.
Okay.
Then
okay,
I will,
fine.
You know, whatever you okay is that we okay. And then
I have anything that I want to cut out of this one. We didn't get so personal with names and all the, you know,
yeah.
Banging on people's heads. We didn't get into that this time.
Yeah, but there might be little things like you, us going off for our drinks and you going.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. We don't want to. It's not that way. Have everyone sitting and listening in separation. Every moment is like 12 years or more. It's not, they're waiting for us to come back. It's not like, yeah, of course.
Have you had, you know, like these kind of questions, I've kind of, some of the ones that I asked you about being a sannyasi and talking about your, you know, your book and women and all this stuff. Have you actually had, say, a discussion with somebody like Vishakha? Who is a leader,
well,
a woman who's taken
a position. Let me tell you, that book got banned. Well, they say they didn't ban it, but the GBC made an absolutely horrible resolution, or they published an absolutely horrible resolution about myself in relation to that book. And that was inspired by the women's ministry and people like Vishakha and others. And none of them had read it at the time. By the way, so they were in Vrindavan and I went there the following Kartik, a few months later, and I wanted to organize, they wouldn't allow my bookstore within the temple, so we did it outside, and I wanted to organize a meeting what are the objections to this book? Please come, we'll have a meeting. And I'll discuss it. It wasn't allowed in the temple. So I had to rent a place outside. And I had my disciples go and personally invite the women who I knew were the ones who were behind all this. They were against this. To personally invite them to come to the meeting. A time was given. A place was given. A date was given. None of them came.
Right.
They didn't want to discuss. It's non-discussable. And I'm fed up, actually, with trying to discuss with the GBC and everything and this and that now, because...
Okay, but maybe... I mean, why... I mean, look, I'm not close with Vishakha, but I knew Yadabara better, but I know that... And she's got this position. Why don't you just organise a private Zoom between you and her or something and have a discussion with, you know, very, you know, softly, just... I mean, otherwise, you see, all these ideas that you've just been talking about today and your vision...
I would have been open to it previously, but what's the way that the politics that's been done... And the way that these issues have been dealt with, some godbrother wrote to me recently and said they're disgusted with some of the things I'm saying. Well, I feel the same way also. I,
Well, why don't you ask...
If there's to be a discussion, it should be done in a formal way with a moderator, and there should be some aim to it also. Because what's going on at the present time is the GBC has the aim to impose female Diksha Gurus to its, what's it called, affirmative action to show that we are in line with the modern society. And they don't, they're making a show of discussing, although they didn't discuss with the Indian leaders. You don't even want to know all this, probably.
I'm intrigued. I know a bit about it. I do, actually.
The Indian leaders had requested that before you make any decision, you please discuss with us. They didn't do that. They went and passed the resolution anyway. Now, what's it called? Post facto, they're making a show of some discussion, but actually they want to ram it through. They don't care what I, and it's not just me, I just happen to be more well-known, but practically all the Indian leaders, the leaders of ISKCON in India, with the exceptions of Jaipitaka Maharaj and Gopal Krishna Maharaj, but most of the, who are the main, two of the main GBCs, but most of their disciples are in leading positions, feel this is wrong, it's going against the culture, and that we want to establish. But the GBC, they don't, the members of the GBC have been, and it's been, I gave one talk about giving an overview of how this whole issue has been political from the beginning. It's highly politicized. And it's very similar to feminists in secular society. They're very political. And if you don't agree with them, then you're a misogynist. That's the word they use. It's a horrible word to say that you hate every woman just because they're a woman. It's a horrible word, but that's the word which is used on the Dandavats way. The Dandavats, anyway, if I get into it too much, the GBC is using the funds that people donate on their Dandavats website to promote an article in which an ISKCON guru says that those who don't agree with this policy, it's misogynism. So what are you going to discuss with people who think that you're a misogynist? If you're a misogynist, it means they think you're a demon. You're a demon or a psychopath. And what are you going to discuss?
But conversely, if you don't mind me saying, one of your talks that you sent one of the lectures that was sent to me was, has kind of evil entered into ISKCON, okay, as well?
Yeah.
See, you know, so my point, and also many of the things you said today, because you're not being a misogynist towards that, but you're being critical of the ISKCON status quo and the kind of like the you know, so you see, this is what happens in dynamics and the problems with unity. I would say that
Mathura Prabhu, if you want to organize a discussion, it should be done publicly. It should be done by groups on both sides.
Yes.
There should be an absolutely neutral mediator, and there should be a purpose to it also.
What would you think
is the GBC willing to change their stance? First of all, I would say they should define what they understand Prabhupada's mission in the world to be. That's the first thing they should do. Because de facto, they're going along with the modern demoniac society. De facto, they're going along with it.
You're using the word should there. Okay. So you are being very demanding about how they should be. Okay. I'm just observing, you see. So,
I tell you, I was willing to discuss on a person-to-person basis previously, but I'm not now because, and I'm very strong now on this, because I do not trust the sincerity of those. But the way they've dealt, the way they behave, I don't believe they're sincere in their dealings.
So how, this is what I suppose...
And I told this, by the way, to the GBCEC last year when they called me. I said, I love you as devotees, but I can't trust you the way you deal.
Okay. In a situation like this, which we may classify, call it conflict resolution, if there is a need...
Who's interested in resolution?
I am.
Why are you interested? Why are you interested?
Shall I tell you why I'm interested?
Yeah.
It's because I'm having this conversation with you. I've never had a conversation with any ISKCON leader for years and years and years. I'm in a specific position in the whole Krishna movement position. You have got a very specific thing. You have very strong views. There's a lot of people that will agree with you and a lot of people disagree. And I think what should happen is before even everybody kind of expecting that the other person has to accept what they have to say, there just needs to be a learning how possibly, despite the fact that trust has been lost, like you said, he's lost a lot of trust.
Okay.
It's just one second. Yeah. It's just communication. I just think that there needs to be somehow or other, I don't know in which format, and I don't mind being a part of it if somebody wants me to be a part of it.
What I'm saying is the onus, as far as I'm concerned, the onus is with the other party, because I have, from what I can see, I've been open to discussion. They didn't want to have it because might is right. Why should we discuss if we can crush you? Mm-hmm. So there comes a point where forget it.
Well, look,
no one's calling for anyway. Yeah.
No, just the fact that
if they call me to discussion, it's just because they want to screw me. That's all. That's what I can see. Okay. They're not interested actually to understand what I have to say or any such thing.
Well, that's a shame, isn't it? It's a real
shame. Yeah. It is. Yeah.
No. Well, look, I really, I would love that somehow or other, as this ISKCON movement or the Christian
movement, it's heading for a schism. It's heading for a schism. It's either going to happen soon or maybe a generation later. There is a major cultural rift within our movement, and it's schismatic. Right. There's in the tectonic plates. There's a major fault and. There's going to be an earthquake. It's inevitable.
And you,
maybe we should stop all these discussions and just admit the fact that we have a major cultural rift, which is not going to get solved. And let's just move on and split the movement peacefully, as peacefully as we can, instead of wasting our these discussions are going. You're saying discussion, but these discussions have been going on for years and no one's listening to each other. Mm-hmm. There's a basic difference in the understanding of what we are supposed to be doing as a movement, and no one's addressing that. That's why I'm saying we should first of all address what is our understanding of what Prabhupada wanted this movement to do, especially in terms of Varnashram. Okay.
Well, look, if I hadn't asked you those questions, I wouldn't have known myself actually what it was that you thought about these things. But actually, I can see that you are very passionate in your beliefs and your point of view, and the fact that you've almost made a prophecy there. You kind of prophesied a kind of something that might happen, and I don't know if you might not have said something like that.
It's nothing new that I'm saying.
I haven't been following all these stories, and loads of other devotees don't know all the stuff that you say and all what's going on. And so these are kind of quite central points in the whole kind of story and evolution of the organization. It could be as big as the Buddhist split in Mathura between the Hinayana and the Mahayana after 400 years after Buddha, isn't it?
Theravada.
They call it Hinayana. Hinayana, Mahayana.
No, Hinayana is a derogatory term.
I know. Okay, but anyway,
I'm not a great fan of Buddhism, but it seems like Theravada is right to me because that's the original thing.
Okay, then you've got the Jains, you've got the sky clad.
Yeah, everywhere. Digambas and Shvetambas.
It's
just like if you're driving a car at 100 miles an hour. And there's a brick wall ahead, and you're not putting the brakes on. It's predictable that you're going to have a smash. I mean, some things are predictable, right? In England now, it's April. It's not very cold. It's not very hot. You can predict it's going to be hotter in 2 months' time. Certain things, they repeat, right?
Yes.
So ISKCON's headed for a schism, and maybe multiple schisms. There hasn't been any religious organization in the world in the history of this Kali Yuga that we know of that hasn't schismatized and again schismatized. And the Catholic Church is pretty amazing in as much as it's been going on for 2,000 years, and it's still one organization all over the world. It's maybe in some ways at its weakest point ever now, but that's pretty amazing, isn't it? You got to give them.
Yeah, except they do have even schisms within that. But
of
yes,
course, yeah. But I'm saying, the fact that
we should end it.
Right? Okay.
Not only that, but
all glories to the Catholic Church. Ave Maria.
I believe.
Kyrie eleison.
I hope that you don't edit out the last bit that you...
No, why? Things. Why should we edit it out?
No, because I think that's a lot of people want to see what you say.
What? You want to say, in my demoniac mood. Yeah, okay. maybe we can Photoshop it. I can put some fangs also.
Anyway, look, it's been great to talk to you. And
But really, you know, you're right. You're absolutely right.
What am I absolutely right
institution,
about?
No institution. The success of the institution will be that people develop Krishna Prem. Otherwise, everything else is ultimately superfluous. And they may not get it in this life, but they may let people make progress.
Yeah, well, Varnashram Dharma, as you say, is a subject that needs to be talked about as a basis for springboard to get to those esoteric places.
Yeah. And to develop the continuity of the Sampradaya also. Continuity means stable society. Children are born in Vaishnava families. They can go on and become gurus and spiritual leaders. There are so many things to say. But right now, I'm just going to say, Vancha kalpa tarubhyas charki bhasa padidanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Let us all go to Mathura, to Vrindavan. Hare Krishna.
Hari Bol.
Hari Bol. Hare Krishna.
Hari Bol. That was great.